would like to call to order the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology. And actually, since we do not have a quorum, Representative Dallum is in the gorge, stuck in traffic, and he was going to chair this committee, so we're not sure when he'll get here. And we know that Representative Dingfelter will not be here, so we have eyes out searching for Representative Krupp so we can have a quorum. But in the meantime, I'd like to open up actually the committee as a subcommittee since we do not have a quorum and we will not go through rules. So I will open this as a subcommittee. And since this is our first meeting and I'm new to this, I would like each person to introduce themselves. And if you have anything to say about this committee, I would appreciate that. We will start with Representative Riley.
Thank you. I'm Representative Chuck Riley. I'm from Hillsboro, Cornelius Forest Grove. I have not served on this committee before. I've read the material, but that's all I know.
All right. Good. Thank you.
I'm Representative Jerry Crummel, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. And so this first person that we're going to see is very familiar to me because he's from the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. I've known Jeff a long time. This is my second interim on the JLCIMT, and I served on the same committee last interim, enjoyed it immensely. I also served on the Information Management Technology Committee on the House side during the session, and so I'm happy to be back and see if we can't keep our computer infrastructure moving in the right direction.
Good, and I'm glad there's someone that has a little bit of background in this. Thanks. Senator Metzger.
Oh, thank you. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, Mount Hood area. I knew it was going to be cold this morning, so I left early. I should have called Representative Dahlem, I guess, and let him know. I'm pleased to be on the committee. I look forward to our first agenda item. I was the one Senate member appointed to the interoperability, state interoperability executive council, so look forward to working on that issue.
Great.
Frank Morris, Senator from Corvallis and Albany. I served last interim also on this committee and enjoyed it. It was a good experience. I think we did some good work, and I look forward to this interim as well.
Great.
I'm David Nelson from Pendleton, and I represent four counties out in eastern Oregon. I've actually been on this committee since 1997.
All right.
They didn't know what to do with me. I see Mike Zanin back in there. I see some old familiar faces from the 97 session that are involved in this thing. But from my sense of this, the House traditionally always took care of kind of the oversight part of it. I mean, they picked on the agencies and were really tough on the agency folks, and the Senate did more kind of the statewide stuff or the, you know, kind of the economic development and that type of thing. And I don't, wherever the chairs want to go with it is fine, but that was kind of the tradition and history of how we operated in the last go-around. So, and it was out of this committee that we brought 622 and all the infrastructure and, I mean, Oregon opportunities growing out of that. So there's a lot of good things that have come out of this committee. And you know, we get asked for money, too, to give the approval to the emergency board, and that's, you know, that's a pretty significant thing. So it's a very significant committee, and I think we've got a lot of work to do. If you read Thomas Friedman's book, and have you read The World is Flat? Mm-hmm. He talks about the reason why it's flat is because of technology, and people are being empowered, and I think we have an opportunity to do some things.
Great. Well, Senator Nelson is actually the one who really got me involved with telecommunications. It started out with, you know, the nursing shortage and how we really need to get information to the far reaches of the state. And so I started attending those telecommunication meetings with Dave, so I have a little bit of knowledge, but just enough to get me in trouble. Anyway, I'm delighted to chair. I'm a senator from the Gresham, Wood Village, Troutdale, Fairview area, and I think we will start then. If you look in your packet, Dallas has really got this organized for us, and we will dispense with the adoption of the rules, and we'll go under section, go straight under section one. You have a list of the members of the committee, and then also the meeting schedule. So if you could get those times in your calendars, next meeting will be January 17th, 2006. And with that, we will go on to our second item on the agenda, which is communications interoperability and report on the current efforts. And that will be Jeff Johnson. And Doug Wilson is going to be my left-hand man here. Dallas is my right-hand.
Madam Chair, if I can open with a couple comments to why this is before you, that might be helpful. At the last e-board, the executive branch brought forth a proposal to add some staff to start beginning working on this issue that you'll hear a lot about this morning. The e-board at that time felt uncomfortable providing all the staff and funding they desired this biennium from the e-fund, and wanted the IMT committee to take a look at that, or this major project, which has a price tag of potentially between $300 and $500 million. These are real rough estimates. But given the nature and the scope of this project, which you'll hear about, it was felt that you needed to get on board to review this, to keep on top of this issue, because this is an issue that will be in front of you as a legislature probably for the next two or three sessions, coming back for funding, looking at other funding sources, including the federal government, as well as potentially bonding as in, or COPs as an alternative. There are a number of efforts are going on that the presenters will discuss with you. There are subcommittees dealing with finance and dealing with local governments on this issue. It is a complex issue and has a number of requirements outlined by the federal government, which you will hear this morning. What I think what LFO is looking for is at least sort of a signal from this committee to go forward and let, if they do come forward to the January e-board for the rest of the funding for this biennium, a go-ahead from you. Now, the funding this biennium is just for planning, and it's not a large sum compared to the overall cost of this project, but it is still a significant amount, and I think they'll probably maybe touch on that during their presentation. If not, I'll touch at the end on that.
How much was the funding this for this session?
I think they requested like 800. I have to go back and take a look at my notes, but it was like 700,000 roughly. Still a sizable sum, but you want to do the planning for this project and the assessment for the need and what needs to be done and do a good job at that.
All right. Questions? Thank you.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Johnson. I'm a fire chief for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. We serve nine cities and three counties in the Portland metropolitan area. It is a pleasure to be here. I serve as chair of the SIEC here in Oregon. And maybe just a second on why I'm involved. I'm involved because the public safety community, police, fire, and all other responders in Oregon, the most important thing you need when you're in field is the ability to talk and the ability to call for resources, to make tactical decisions and communicate those decisions to the people that are placed in harm's way, and to have as real-time as possible information moving from the databases out to the people in the field. And the fact is that in Oregon, our system is approaching, and I don't think collapse would be an overstatement, our system is approaching a very dire point in its life cycle, and it needs to be addressed. Today, myself and my colleagues from the committee intend to talk to you about House Bill 2101 and the interoperability planning that it requires. And one of the things it requires is the addition of two representatives from the legislature. And we welcome Senator Metzger and Representative Boquist to the Interoperability Council. We will also talk about today the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network. And I'd describe that as today Oregon has four state-owned systems, that being with ODOT, Corrections, Forestry, and the Oregon State Police. And those systems are not really engineered or tied together in a fashion that facilitates the ability to move between them easily, or the ability for local responders who work often with state resources to access them when they need to. Depending on which system we're talking about, they're reaching various points of obsolescence. And then lastly, we want to talk to you about what the SIEC is targeting in our strategic plan and our partnerships, moving those four state systems into one, a deadline set by the FCC, which is 2013, and public safety access at the local level, both for interoperability emergent communications and for local providers the option to pay a fee to utilize this state system, and our responsibility to build that system in a manner that makes that attractive for local providers to say, I don't want to spend the money to build my own. It's a better business decision to buy into the state's capacity. After me sometime, John Koreski will talk briefly about what our finance committee is doing and some thoughts he has on how we're going to recommend that you fund this thing should it move forward. But before I turn it over, I want to touch briefly on the SIEC and its history. This thing was actually created by executive order by Governor John Kitzhaber in January of 2002. It doesn't take a lot of math to figure that wasn't long after we began to realize that in September 11th, communications was a big problem with why emergency responders were not able to get themselves out of harm's way. And whether it's September 11th or Hurricane Rita or Katrina, or you pick the natural disaster or man-inflicted disaster, you will always see in the top three problems communications, operability, and interoperability, because really in the hurricane situation the problem wasn't interoperability, it was operability. The system just flat out failed. So we need to address some of those things today. I want to talk about how the state and local partnership is intended to work and the basic mission to achieve interoperability. And interoperability, I guess I'd describe it. I'm a fire chief, so I'm a simple guy looking for simple solutions. But interoperability means this: the ability to talk to the people you need to talk to when you need to talk to them, get the data you need when you need it, and essentially, to put it in very practical terms, to create roaming for public safety radios. You know, it seems so simple when we can buy a phone in Wilsonville and drive to Roseburg and it still works. The fact is, with public safety radios, you take those $4,000 or $5,000 handsets, and once you're out of your primary area, they don't work. They don't work at all. And it doesn't take a lot of imagination to contemplate wildland firefighters from both local jurisdictions, state resources, and federal resources. They're all dissimilar. They're in places where there aren't radio signals. They don't work. The same is true in police pursuits. The same is true in urban search and rescue. And the fact is, because Oregon is so progressive in how we share resources, and this isn't common throughout the country, but when there's a problem in Portland, Oregon will dump its resources to Portland to help, and vice versa. That means that we're working together a lot, and we need to be able to talk. It's important in this conversation to place a few things into context. First, it is not an overstatement to say the state systems are failing. They are inadequate, and they are segmented. It is not an overstatement to say the FCC is requiring major systems to all your state-owned systems by 2013. Those are mandated changes, and the state and local governments must comply. These are not something that we can put off. And the SIEC sees the investment in a consolidated state communication system and a digital backbone as the only realistic way to achieve interoperability. And if you imagine that this process started in 2002, and here we are almost 4 years later, the fact that the SIEC, with state, tribal, and local government involvement, the fact that this thing hasn't come apart over petty bickering and the kinds of things that happen when you put those kind of partners in a room together, the fact that we have not come apart, but in fact we've grown stronger in one vision, I think is a very strong indicator that we're on to something. How often do you see these things start, but come apart, or fail because the vision fails? The reality is this is a strong vision that has broad support at the state level, tribal level, and at local government level, and especially with your experience dealing with the complex policy issues, I mean, that is a real indicator we're on the right path. I think also we believe that we must not recreate the wheel, but take the systems that we have and not only update them, but connect them together in a fashion that gets maximum use of them. For lack of a clear way to describe it, we'll be providing bridges between these systems, or technology gateways for our radio systems that make them operate as one. We call it the systems of systems, literally creating electronic bridges between them, taking the strengths of each system and hooking them together. We must not foresee, or we do not foresee, a practical need for a mandate for local governments to connect. It's when we start giving the impression to local governments that we're going to take away their ability to build and maintain their own systems that we begin to get fragmented and get a lot of pushback. Local control, as you know, is a big issue. But really our challenge is, can we build a system that makes them say, why would I want to spend the kind of money it takes to build my own system when that system right there over my head is more robust, more redundant, more reliable, and I can do it at a better price? Our challenge is to build a system that creates a cost advantage for them to belong to it. It's our belief that the federal government should be a major source of financing for the communications infrastructure necessary to create the statewide IO system, the Oregon Wireless Interoperability System, or network, ON as we would call it. We believe that we can achieve that. We believe that should be your expectation, that we achieve that. And very candidly, it's consistent with the federal government's goals to make interoperability at the state level a very high priority, because frankly, when they come to town with their resources, they need to talk, and they need to talk to us. So they're very, very contiguous, they're like goals, and they are demonstrating in every way that they're willing to be there for us. Lastly, I want to emphasize that what we're talking about is not a disaster communication system. This is not something that we intend to flip on when bad things happen here. And whether that's a tsunami, a major earthquake, a windstorm, or a domestic or foreign terrorist event, this is something that we intend to use every day. Police, fire, and all other emergency responders, it's about moving voice and data from the people that have the information base out to the people that need it. It wasn't very long ago where there was a very lucky but very fortuitous arrest following the Oklahoma City bombing, where a single patrol officer in the field made an arrest hours away from Oklahoma City, realized things weren't right, and we ended up with a very lucky intervention there. The fact is, today there are major flaws, and Representative Patridge used to make this case to me often. If there is an APB put out in Portland, and the victim or the assailant identified in the APB, if they move down the freeway to Medford and a Medford police officer pulls them over, what's the likelihood that that police officer is going to have a picture of them, the information of them, and the critical information that they need to realize this is a problem? Today's system, frankly, does not facilitate that in an effective and efficient manner. These are the kind of things that we hope to address with this. At the emergency board, Senator Schrader said that he was not interested in creating a system for Armageddon, and frankly, this entire group agrees. This system is one that allows us to talk not just during a disaster, but every day, and that means a great deal for the public we serve and protect, and the protection of our property, and candidly, our economy. This is a big deal. There's big numbers associated with it. There's a lot of local and state and partner-based planning that goes into it. And I can offer you my assurance as the chair of the committee, and you will have legislative representatives participating to verify that. But we are watching for every opportunity to make this the most cost-effective answer for the state, whether that's public-private partnerships, federal participation, state participation, and local government participation. We'll really look to draw all those resources into what we think will be a cost-effective solution for the next 15 to 20 years. And with that, if there aren't any questions for me, who probably knows the least about the technical components and the most about the critical vision and importance of this, I'd like to turn that over to Beverly Stillwell.
I have a quick question.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. You've talked with Frenziari and Hermiston, the Hermiston Police Department?
I have not personally, no, sir.
Somebody better do that, because they're doing exactly the same thing you're asking about. In fact, Fred Ziari's company, Easy Wireless, has just entered into a contract with TSA, Transportation Security, whatever it is,
Administration,
for non-airport issues. So he basically, from his office or wherever, he can watch the Columbia River, McNary Dam, I think he can watch John Day Dam, he can watch Union Pacific Railroads, he can watch Interstate 84 and Interstate 82. And I mean, he has a system in place now. It basically comes out of the chemical depot situation where they sent out those little, you know, Dick Tracy things. Nobody can operate them, but Fred figured out a way to do that. And so, I mean, if you're looking for somebody that has a solution, and if you talk to him at $300 to $500 million, he'll say, that's nuts. I can do it for a lot cheaper than that. I can tell you that right now and do a good job of it. In fact, he's talking with the Department of Transportation. Peter Burns, does that name strike anybody? I think that's it. About trying to get the Department of Transportation to do things along all the interstates. Mm-hmm. And he thinks he can do it at, you know, probably, it'll probably be millions of dollars, but it's certainly not $300 to $500 million or whatever scary figure that is. But.
Well, Chair Anderson and Senator Nelson, you know, those are the kinds of things we're interested in. I think Beverly Stillwell and Ken Murphy have been having those conversations. I know Beverly spent a big chunk of her life in that world, getting very familiar with it. And those are the kind of solutions we'll be looking for, and we are very motivated to drive whatever number we're talking about down. And if there are technologies and systems that are secure and achieve our goals, you know, we're going to embrace them. The reality is that not very many years ago, now I can't hardly even say, 28 years ago when I got in this business, there were radio people, and then there were computer people, and never did those worlds meet. And today, radio folks and computer folks, it's really merged into one world, and it's about how do you take your voice and convert it to ones and zeros and move that information and reconvert it when you need to move it out over the airwaves. We really know that's the future. So if there's systems that we can replicate, incorporate, and build in, we're going to be looking for them. So much of Oregon is remote, and the mountainous areas require more towers. You know, those are the kind of things that really create the complexities of it. You know, to serve the metropolitan area that we operate in, it's a simpler solution. than finding a way to get signal in every canyon in the Wallowas. And I don't think every canyon in the Wallowas is practical without some mobile applications. But so those are the things we're looking at. We certainly would love to be made aware of them. We probably are talking to them, but we'll embrace them if there's a better way to do it. You know, kind of our philosophy as it relates to rolling out that number of 400 to 500 million. But one thing I should make clear is that we have not had an engineering study that gave us that number. Thankfully, the legislature and the Office of Emergency Management have allocated the money for us to get some of that engineering work done. And they're also going to recommend what they think is the most logical technological solution for how we go about this. But we think one of the biggest mistakes we could make is to come in here and tell you, we think we can get this done for 100 million, then start talking 400 and 500. That is a dangerous situation. We'd rather start what we believe is the high end, based on talking to our colleagues in other states, and then come in with a very nice surprise that we found a better way. Please appreciate we're trying to be conservative in terms of not surprising you, and if we can find a better way, we'll do it.
Thank you. Yes. Representative Crummell.
Thank you. I just have a couple of questions that I'd like to just kind of toss out there, Jeff. And you know, you mentioned that as a fire chief, you're looking at simplistic ways, and I can guarantee you that nobody looks more simplistic than I do. Matter of fact, sometimes I think it's ridiculously simple. But has the council talked to providers such as Nextel? I mean, we see people walking around with the walkie-talkie phones, and they can, you know, talk to anybody anywhere in the world, quite frankly, and they're all on, as long as they're part of that network, they can utilize it. And it doesn't appear as though they, you know, dial any special numbers or anything. They just have to, I don't know, you know, I've used one once, and it was the regular user was right there to show me what to do, which was push a button. And then so I guess that's one thing I'd like to just ask, has the council considered something along those lines? And then the other and that goes along with using networks that are already in place. But the other one is I'm a member of OnStar, because I mm-hmm. bought a Avalanche a number of years ago, and I just keep renewing. I can be I'm driving from Drain to Reedsport. I couldn't get any kind of reception with my cell phone, and the people that I was going to meet in Bandon were waiting for us, and so I used my satellite phone in my car. I mean, they can track you anywhere. And if I push the emergency Red Cross button in my car, they can get, you know, they can contact authorities to let them know where in the world I am, based on a GPS system and that sort of thing. So has the council looked at the possibility of being able to contract with a network like that's already in place, that can that utilizing satellite capabilities allows anywhere communication, and like I said, this may be real, you know, simplistic, but I'm just thinking that, you know, in some respects the private sector may have already done a lot of this work for us. I guess one of the things, and I am in favor of having an interoperable system. I think it's absolutely essential that, and I've said this many times, especially in 03 when the General Government Committee was looking at this issue very, very hard, that I was the chair of, a comment that I made many times was that, you know, from coast to coast and border to border, we need to be able to talk to each other in times of emergencies, and that agencies need to be able to communicate back and forth and that sort of thing. But I'm just wondering if those are some of the things if some of those things have already been looked at from a standpoint of how we put this all together.
Well, Chair Anderson, Representative Crummell, those are excellent questions, and clearly we've discussed them. I don't think we're at the engineering phase, and if it would be okay with you, I'd like to defer to Don Fole, a bona fide smart guy when it comes to technology, to talk about through our partnership efforts, how we're going to look at moving data through some of these kinds of partnerships with the private sector. He can talk about the satellite capability and the speed at which we can move data. And he can probably wander in the areas of frequency agile radios and cognitive radios, which are just now emerging out of DARPA and some of those things. I think we are considering them, to assure you, and there may be a place in them. There'll be a byproduct of some of the engineering work that's yet to come. But if you wouldn't mind, Representative, I'd like to let Don Fole address those issues.
Thank you. Well, according to the agenda, it's Beverly Stilwell and Ken Murphy that are up next.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Beverly Stilwell, and I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Homeland Security. I'm here before you today to provide a brief overview of House Bill 2101. It provides the foundation for the work that the SIEC is doing and also the replacement of wireless communication systems in the state of Oregon. Basically, the legislature found exactly what Chief Johnson is talking about, that the systems that currently first responders and public safety personnel use are outdated, are deteriorating, and are on the brink of failure. Parts are having to be purchased off of eBay. Much of the system is 30 plus years old, and I know that Don Fole will go into greater detail right after me to talk about the nature of the system, the outages that are currently being experienced by our first responders, and the vision for being able to address that. Additionally, House Bill 2101 recognized what Chief Johnson mentioned with the Federal Communication Commission's mandates for moving to narrowband spectrum by 2013. And while that's not the driving force for replacement of the radio system, it is a critical milestone that's out there that we must be able to achieve in order to maintain compliance with FCC standards for interoperable and radio communications. House Bill 2101 places the responsibility for the planning, the operations, and the maintenance upon Oregon Emergency Management. And Ken Murphy, the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, will be providing an overview to this committee of our most recent appearance before the Emergency Board, the positions that were asked for, and the funding that was received to initially keep the project going in the path that it has originally been on. House Bill 2101 also addresses the critical issue of financing. Obviously, you've heard a little bit of the sticker shock today of anywhere from $300 to $500 million, and we take that very seriously. And the committee does agree that we want to drive that price down. We will look at every method possible to be able to connect in with existing systems, existing technology. I am familiar with the technology over in CSEP, and it's a fantastic technology for that application. It probably is difficult to be able to replicate on a statewide basis because of the number of towers that are necessary in order to do it, but it's definitely something to look at. It's where can we take and apply that technology in certain areas where it would be economically feasible. That's one thing that we found very difficult in CSEP was the siting of the towers and the land use issues. And we're going to look...
For those of us who are CSEP, help us with the acronym.
My apologies. The Chemical Stockpile Emergency Preparedness Program. And that is the emergency preparedness program in support of the Umatilla Chemical Demilitarization Facility, where they have the 3,700 tons of nerve agent that they're currently incinerating. So in looking back at the financing issue of it, John Koreski is the chair of the Subcommittee on Finance of the SIEC, and he is with the Department of Corrections and will be providing a report to this committee on the different avenues that we are looking at, both state, federal, and possibly subscriber fees for those that want to participate to be able to finance this system. We're working with our congressional contingent to be able to look at possibly getting earmarks on federal legislation to be able to leverage federal dollars to the greatest extent possible. What we are seeing along the line of Homeland Security dollars is they're not coming to the state in the quantities that we have seen in the past. We're starting to see those to be more quasi-competitive and less just a formula allocation to the state. So we're going to look to Homeland Security dollars, but we're also looking to other sources of funding because obviously the Homeland Security dollars are not in great enough amount to be able to fund a project of this scope. I'd like to take just a few minutes to talk about a success story of state agency collaboration. And that's a group that was formed nearly a year ago of state agency counterparts to look at the replacement of the statewide infrastructure, knowing that this was an issue. It brought together representation from the state police, Homeland Security, military department, transportation, corrections, forestry, and also an element of human services that has the EMS, Emergency Medical System, function. They have been working together to identify the best way to replace the statewide system and meet the mandates of House Bill 2101 for a single consolidated state public safety system. The group developed an RFP within 2 month time, which is an absolutely amazing feat in itself. That RFP is currently under review for award, hopefully the first part of December, to look at the engineering and design services of the replacement for the statewide system that would allow not only replacement of the statewide backbone, but allow for interoperability for other units of government, including local, tribal, and federal units. Don Full, as I said earlier, will be providing an overview not only of the RFP, but of also the conceptual design of the current system, some of the shortfalls of it, the differences that we currently have in radio sites, the numerous sites that are owned by the Department of Forestry, Department of Transportation, and the State Police, and looking how there is overlap and where we could take and have efficiencies by utilizing sites of various agencies into a single system and then maybe not using some sites in the future and allow for greater interoperability and coverage. In closing, the presentations that you're going to hear throughout the remainder of the day, I think are going to give you a solid understanding of the nature and extent of the communication system that currently exists for our first responders. It will give you an idea of the steps that have been taken to try and develop the infrastructure replacement plan as mandated in House Bill 2101. And it would also give you the mechanisms that we're currently look at to be able to provide the necessary investments into the replacement of the state system. That concludes my testimony. I would happen to be answering any questions that you may have specifically on House Bill 2101.
Questions, committee? Yes, Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Were you aware that TSA had contracted with Fregiari or Easy Wireless? Were you aware that that had happened? And was there any communication between TSA and you folks? I mean, if we're going to do the federal things, there seems to be some issues there.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, yes, Ken Murphy has been very involved in that. I have actually been out there, and I have seen demonstrations of the system that Fred has put in for CSEP. I lived in the community for about a year working on securing adequate emergency preparedness prior to incineration of the nerve agent at the depot. And we have ongoing communications with Morrow and Umatilla County and Fred. And like I say, wherever we can fit this application into a statewide plan, we'll be looking at every economy that we can possibly get from it.
I was talking more. The CSEP is one program, and Transportation Security Administration is another program. I mean, so what I'm seeing out there is that he's building onto these things. He's got the CSEP over here. Now he's got the TSA. I know that he just contracted with the City of Vancouver, Washington, to provide police security and things of that nature. So, I mean, to me, there's a system out there. But the TSA never contacted the Homeland Emergency folks? Or?
Ken Murphy has been involved with that particular project and has attended meetings and has attended demonstrations of it. So we have ongoing communication with Fred and the component that includes TSA and expansion up and down the Columbia River.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, Ms. Stillwell. Mr. Murphy? Okay.
Madam Chair,
yes.
One thing we wanted Mr. Fole to do is to make sure that you folks sort of had a basic understanding at this meeting of the technology and the sort of the mechanics of how all this comes together. So we had asked the parties involved to make sure that he had enough time to make sure you understood sort of how the system works and what it's required. Not so much the financial or the statutory requirements, but the technology base that you need to go ahead and make decisions in the future.
Thank you.
Yeah, good morning. I'm Don Fole, Communications Manager for State Police. I also chair the Technical Committee of the SIEC. I'd like to talk to you this morning a little bit about a high-level overview of the state system itself and in state systems in general. What I'd like to talk about is the state of the current systems, a little bit about OWIN, about the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, a little bit about interoperability, and these will all be high-level views. The idea of trunking, which is applicable when you consolidate state agencies. It's a way to get more efficiency. Talk about state radio facilities and the shape they're in today. The Integrated Wireless Network, which is the federal law enforcement program for nationwide federal interoperability. And then a little bit about the consulting contract that we have underway today. In current systems, basically the technology that all the major state systems use today is 50-year-old technology. It's FM, developed after World War II. It has gone through some changes along the way, just to narrow the channel that's occupied, in order to get more users into the spectrum, and that is the reason why the FCC has mandated further changes by 2013. The fact that the FCC, there is a limited amount of spectrum. The FCC says that the way to get more users into the spectrum is to narrow each one of them up so that you can just simply put more and more people into the same spectrum. All of the state radio systems have coverage problems varying by agency. One of the critical things is that if you look at a statewide basis, all of them use a manual selection of the talk path, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Most of them repeat, and that is basically a radio that, say, a trooper has in a car will do a pretty good job for maybe 5 miles if the terrain is flat for car to car. But after that, it's entirely terrain driven, whether you can communicate it or not. If there's a hill in the way, then after a few miles, you can't communicate. And so there are two factors in how well a radio system like this works. One is the height of the antenna, and then the other is the power. And in that equation, height always wins. The higher you get, the more country you can see from the vantage point. And so that's why these stations are on mountaintops. The bad part about mountaintops is that for every mile that you have between the mountaintop transmitter and the mobile or the portable radio, there's a loss. And the loss gets larger and larger every time you double the amount of mileage. And so what typically is done is that the car or the handheld radio on the street transmits on one frequency, receives on another. And so the car transmits, the signal goes through a repeater on the mountaintop and then comes back to broaden the coverage. OSP and ODOT also connect most of their facilities. OSP, I think, entirely connects all of their mountaintop transmitters to dispatch centers over the microwave system. And law enforcement, as I'm sure you can appreciate, is a base to mobile type operation. It's headquarters to the unit. The repeat function locally lets the troopers and deputies out there hear each other locally, but it is a base to mobile kind of operation. And it takes a microwave system in order to do that. And today, none of the departments have any voice and data capability. You see Blackberries, you see all of these kind of things today, and you see the technology that is available, certainly in the metropolitan areas, none of that is available. Before I came here, I put in my fifth generation of mobile data system. When I got here, I found the state police has no mobile data. They have no way in a vehicle to do a wants and warrants check directly from the car. All of that has to be done by voice. Why change? I won't go through these in depth because Beverly went through the requirements of 2101. Really, the FCC requirement for a mandated change by 2013 is an absolute in my mind, because we've been at this for about 20 years at the FCC, dealing with whether they should mandate this or not. For about 10 years, they chose not to mandate. Finally, they recognized that unless they set a date certain that everybody had to move, nobody would move. The economics were just not there to get thousands, 80,000 public safety agencies in the country to move. The systems are in deteriorating condition, state systems. Again, these come out of 2101, and there is little or no interoperability within state government. We have some, we do a patchwork, state police. We have about half a dozen offices where we have two radios in a vehicle. Over in Ontario, for example, we have UHF radios in our vehicles to be able to communicate with Idaho State Police. And we do that in a couple areas throughout the state. We have about almost 20 radios on the City of Portland system in the patrol division out of Portland. Within OSP, over 100 of our critical base stations are over 20 years old, and 45 of those are 25 years old. I was a chief radio engineer for Department of Forestry from 1997 to 86. And in 1977, when I went to work for Forestry, we installed the radios that are still in service in state police. And I think you can imagine that if you had a community of 25-year-old, 35-year-old television sets, that doesn't happen. The reliability alone and the inconvenience of that thing dying all the time is a reason to say that at some point in time you need to replace it. General industry replacement would say that about 10 years you need to start a replacement cycle on that stuff, because the reliability goes down all the time. And the bottom bullet there is really the critical bullet, that every time something fails, it's a technical inconvenience, but somebody just lost communications. There's a hole in the system out there where there is no communications. A little bit about how these systems work, and I'll give an example of the Enterprise Patrol Office over in Wallowa County. That office includes both patrol and Fish and Wildlife Division personnel. They have two repeaters, Howard Butte in the north, Mount Howard in the south. The office radio system is on the same frequency as LeGrand and Pendleton, and so basically what you have is three operational units out there, all on the same frequency, all interfering with each other. They override each other. The troopers in the field often can't hear themselves another district, and so they come on the air, and the dispatcher now is hearing two or three people all on the same frequency. This is a picture that was just taken up at Howard Butte. This is a Department of Forestry site. They have a lookout tower on there. The lookout tower was condemned 5 years ago, and our antennas are on it, and our solar panels are on it. This is a solar-operated site. More than dangerous to climb. There's a note on there that says the footing forms are for a new 120-foot-tall tower. We installed that tower about a month ago. And we will transfer our equipment off of that lookout tower onto a steel tower. Also at the same time, Lowell County Sheriff is going to go into that building with us with several of their transmitters. This is one of the better sites in North Lowell County, especially to cover the roadways. This is just a pictorial of the system that is used over there. Lowell County on the right, Union County on the left. There are two repeaters in the site, Howard Butte in the north, Mount Howard in the south. I've shown the two major patrol roads, State Road 3 and State Road 82, that runs from Enterprise down to LeGrand. If this unit up near Howard Butte wanted to transmit, it just simply pushes the button inside of his car, and that goes through the repeater. Now the repeater turns on and broadcasts throughout the area, and it also part of that signal in this case goes down to Mount Emily outside of LeGrand, where we have a control station. It's a receiver that's listening on the Howard Butte system. This is a representation, a very good representation of the coverage that you actually get off of Howard Butte. And you notice a lot of white in there. White is where there is no coverage. That is where the minus signal is too low for reliable communications with the vehicle. You see a lot of white, and you see a lot of streak lines through those. So those are ravines, draws, canyons. The reality is that these systems do not, unless they look right down a canyon, they won't get, for the most part, get radio signal into the canyon. And so this says that the more coverage you need, the more reliability you need, the more stations you have to put up just to start covering these small areas.
Mr. Fool?
Yes.
When you're talking about base stations, how many base stations are, say, in that district?
There are, I believe, 7 total sites within the district. Only 2 of them our state police, and I'll go into that a little bit more about a little later about what the state actually has and what each department has in that county.
Thank you.
But public safety itself, the county, state of Iowa has a site in Wallowa County, looking back across the Snake River into Idaho, and this shows the microwave system that is connected off of Mount Emily. That takes the information from this system and routes it back to Central Point. And that's what it takes, the microwave system. This is an actual footprint of how that microwave system signal is sent back to Central Point. OSP has 2 dispatch centers, one here in Salem for the north part of the state, one in Central Point for almost all of eastern Oregon and northeast Oregon. And that is the actual picture of the Southern Command Center in Central Point, the end point. So these dispatchers are talking through that radio in north of Wallowa to that Central Point or that Enterprise troop. Well, I'm going to back this up just a moment here. You see the car on the right. That car is out near Imnaha. Within the district, because it's a manual selection in the car, the trooper selects Howard Butte because that's where the trooper is. The trooper out near Imnaha doesn't hear him. He's outside the coverage range of Howard Butte. And so the radio that would be covering that trooper near Imnaha is would be Mount Howard, but there's no signal on the air. So this is one of the huge problems with manual selection in the car, the fact that people in the same patrol area cannot hear each other because they're on different resources. This is a picture of the dispatch console screen. I put this in there because it's a computer. It is a PC. The software loaded on it is it's a touch screen. You can actually touch those buttons. And in fact, if you touch that button right there, The operator will transmit on the Enterprise on the Howard Butte system. They can do that with a foot switch, or they have wear headsets and could speak through the radio, speaking through a computer. I put this in because so far I've only been talking about the Enterprise office. I want to give you a feel of the scope of the whole state. Every one of those dots up there is a state police transmit location. And they are there because of these coverage problems. State police has both the patrol division and the Fish and Wildlife Division. And we have people within various divisions whose responsibility is to go everywhere. Not just on the freeways, not just on the major highways, but everywhere. And that leads to a very strong system to be able to support that. Also, it's hard to see, but there's a pink area on the top. That pink shaded area is the area which is dispatched by the Northern Command Center here in Salem. The beige kind of area on the bottom is that area that is dispatched by out of Central Point. How does the system work? The operator has to know what resource to select. OSP has mostly 160 channel radios, and we have 103 sites and 118 repeaters throughout the state. In 160 channel radios, we use all of the radio frequencies up. That's because we have our own system to take care of statewide, but it's also because to the extent that we can, we try to put the sheriff's office frequency, the U.S. Forest Service, law enforcement, all of those systems on the same radio to the extent we can. But about 200 of OSP's radios are 80 channel radios. They cannot even operate throughout the state. 3 years ago, during the wildfires that we had, forest fires down near Grants Pass, I had people out on the road along Interstate 5 in southern Oregon intercepting troopers who were on their way to the fire to reprogram their radios so that they could work on the fire when they got there, and then we had to reprogram them back when they got back home. One of the critical things is that it's an operator selection. They have to know where they are. And in the reverse direction, the dispatcher has to know where they are in order to be able to use the correct transmitter. And this is a great part of the operational problem that we have with the current system. Operators frequently select different stations. That Naha case and the Howard case. Each one of those vehicles is near the transmitter, and so they select the transmitter that they're near, but those they don't hear each other. And loss of a station in that case results in a total loss of an area. If Howard Butte goes down, we just lost all of northern Wallowa County. We have nothing else to be able to cover that part of the country. That brings us to the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network. What does the state think that we can do about this? The O1 project is actually in four parts. I made a statement about, just after Katrina, a week or so after Katrina, I was in a meeting, and I said, I haven't talked to anybody in Louisiana or Mississippi about this specifically, but I know why their systems failed. And the systems failed because the infrastructure failed. The buildings became flooded. The buildings for the first 72 hours at least, you have to be completely self-sufficient to keep things running with emergency power. Emergency power plants failed. Towers blew down. I read an article this last week that I think you have a copy of somewhere, which talks about some of the history of Katrina and the major part of the infrastructure dying there was not the loss of the towers and the microwave, but the loss of commercial backhaul signal. Leasing T1 lines from the carriers to backhaul information from the sites, those failed. Within the same article, I think, said within the first month after Katrina, the largest microwave company in the country sold 100 links of microwave. They had to get microwave out there to replace those commercial systems that failed.
Let's just hold Representative Dallin. We're glad to see you here safely.
Thank you. My apologies.
No problem. We are under tab 2. We have not gone through the rules. I'm wondering if we should continue with this, and then after you have finished your presentation, we'll go in and adopt the rules, if that's all right. Okay.
So the first thing that has to be done on behalf of the state is to build a survivable infrastructure. That is, the buildings and the towers. Those have to be built to a strength that are going to be able to survive, going to be able to last at least through the major part of any incident. But more importantly, at least half of the failures that we see every day are related to the buildings, the towers, the power. Those contribute at least half to the outages that the radio equipment itself does. The second part is a digital trunk radio system, reliable backhaul and connection of all of that information across the state. That high-speed digital system would connect all the sites to each other and to the dispatch centers. And in an internet-like data network that could ride on that microwave system that then supports interoperability. And if your goal, as the SIC's goal is, a system of systems to be able to tie things together that exist out there and allow agencies' jurisdictions to own and operate their own radio systems, then you have to figure out how to connect that stuff together, and you have to do it reliably. And the state's microwave system can do that. Owen is planning for this. The consolidated system began with the passage of 2101. It will consolidate state agencies onto a single trunk radio system. And that's an important part that I'll talk a little bit more about in trunking. But Owen also needs to take on the state's responsibility of interoperability. And I like to look at this as a national problem. If we are ever to have nationwide interoperability, it is going to be done, I think, on the basis of state systems. It is not possible, in my estimation, to just throw money to 80,000 different agencies and have them come out in the end with a solution that's going to work. That won't happen.
Question.
Yes.
If we go with the wireless system, which I can't imagine we will not, will this work very well then with Idaho, with Washington? Are they starting to look at wireless systems? Do they have wireless systems in place now?
They are doing the same thing that we're doing. A little bit different way to do it, but basically the same thing that we're doing. And I've had discussions with California, Idaho, and Washington, conceptual discussions, saying that as we move along and we move into Owen, what do you think about the idea of the state sharing a common system along the borders? Rather than each one of us build a system out there and have two systems along the border, because we each have to do that, how about if we built a single system? A lot of technical advantages to that, because if we each build a system, we have to be very careful. We have to take enormous pains not to interfere with each other. But if we shared a system, then we build a common infrastructure, and we build an automatic way to have interoperability completely through between the states. And so we've had those discussions. The immediate answer that I got back from all three states was we are extremely interested in doing that. We would like to look at that.
Yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding of the technology of all this was very limited, so my questions may reflect that. But have you explored the satellite as opposed to the land-based towers and systems?
I think that there certainly are applications for satellites. Their biggest application is backhaul. The one of the problems with satellites, and we use satellites within Oregon State Police during the summertime with a cadet program in the along the Deschutes River. Even satellites cannot cover the Deschutes. There is a lack of coverage in Deschutes. One of the big problems is that satellite is about 22,500 miles away from Earth on the equator. And by the time the signal gets to us, it is very, very low, very weak. And it also is in a part of the band, a microwave part of the band, which is easily shaded by trees, by foliage. Your GPS unit won't hardly work inside the house because you're not able to see satellites. But for backhaul, for connecting systems together, there is a great, I think, advantage to the use of satellites. So incorporating that within the whole picture, I think, is something that will happen.
In conjunction with the question that Representative Kermel asked with the OnStar system, how does that function?
Well, to my knowledge, OnStar uses a cellular telephone for the uplink, and part of that uplink in the car is a regular cellular telephone that then encodes information from the car and says where I am. It is looking at GPS, and it says, where am I? It downloads that to OnStar. And so OnStar doesn't look downward and detect you. You actually send the information to them saying where you are. But it is a cellular-based system, and that's why in my car, when they call me, it says phone, and then I answer that. But it is a cellular kind of a system that uses the global positioning system for location.
Representative Dowell?
Yes. With that cellular system, does that have any propensity to offer a solution on the Deschutes? Would that system work on the Deschutes, a cellular
the
system?
The OnStar?
Yes.
It might. It might, but the... One of the problems that you have in using Nextel or any of the cellular or the PCS systems is that a kind of a rule of thumb in the industry is that every time they build a site, that's $1 million. If they have to go in and put a building up, a tower up, and then put the equipment in it and get the backhaul, that's $1 million. And so just economics says that they're only going to go where a customer base is. And that's why they are pretty much along the interstates. You lose them sometimes, you drop a call. But they're pretty much in the population centers. So to look at the very rural areas, it's not economical for the companies to be able to do that. We're in a process right now where Highway 97 goes across the Deschutes into the Warm Springs Reservation, just north of Madras. We're now in the process of putting our third cellular carrier onto the State Police Tower there, because they are, as they branch out and as they increase their system, they're starting to cover places like that.
When we talk about rural Oregon, And the genesis of the conversation is on statewide safety. Is there any system that will provide statewide safety emergency systems to rural Oregon? Or are we along the I-5 corridor and the 84 corridor?
The closest system today is that which is in State Police. State Police has 103 sites throughout the whole state. I believe that ODOT has about 80 or 90 sites. Department of Forestry has about 60 sites throughout the state. The reason, ODF, Forestry, their responsibility is state and private lands, and so that's all they cover. So the big, the reservations, the federal lands, they don't have equipment out there. That's why they only have 60 sites. State Police, because of the Fish and Wildlife troopers who have to go everywhere, and for the other divisions that go everywhere in the state, we have to try to cover as much of it as possible. One of the design goals I want to talk about a little bit later for Owen is, I would like to say, have a design goal of coverage of the state, coverage of 95% of the state by county. So that rather than just say 95% of the state and leave a big hole somewhere, that we bore down to the county level and we say, how can we get reliable public safety radio coverage of every county to a level of 95%? And that it'd be nice to say 100% or as close as we could get, and we may do that in some cases, but getting that last few percent is extremely costly. By the time you start to get into these canyons and into these places that limit coverage, you're in a law of diminishing returns. There just is no way that you can afford to get that. So of the systems that exist today, I would say state police has the most coverage of any system in the state.
But still not adequate. Yes. So what I think I'm hearing you say is then we may need more than one or two systems going at the same time?
Yes, that's one of the issues about consolidation is that presently, and I'll use the Wallowa County example again, we have ODOT transmitters there, we have forestry transmitters there, we have state police transmitters there. And you might think that that's a huge duplication. Well, it's not, because each one is limited to a talk band. The forestry unit is for forestry-related business and so on. And so what happens now is if you have a big wildfire going up north of La Grande, Department of Forestry has access to their system. They don't have access to transportation and state police, because if they use those systems, then they would just completely wipe out all transportation activity and all police activity. So the way that these have evolved over the years, they're individual little stovepipes. But in consolidation and by using trunking, there is a way to combine all of those three into a common system. And those three now have the effect of greatly increasing efficiency. If you were to take, for example, three transmitters from those three major agencies, instead of having three discrete talk paths, if you trunk them, now you could probably have 10 talk paths, because it is a statistics game at that point, saying that not everybody wants to talk at the same time, and they're sharing the resource. If somebody needs to talk, they're assigned a resource and a fewer number of transmitters. So everybody, through consolidation and through pooling together into a common system, everybody gets huge advantages in what they can do throughout the whole state.
Representative Riley.
Thank you. just a technical point. I wanted you to explain to me the term backhaul.
Oh, backhaul is when the, for example, the receiver that is on Mount on Howard Butte up near Wallowa, that receiver receives a signal and now it converts that signal into electrical current and that needs to be connected somewhere. Backhaul is the system from that site to Central Point.
Okay,
that is connecting the information from the transmitter to the operator. Interoperability, I want to talk a little bit about this, because this is important in the system of systems idea. There are six classical levels of interoperability. At very low is you swap radios. And we've been doing this for years. Drug enforcement things with the FBI, with DEA, where we will take radios out, the FBI will give us radios, or we give them radios. So we're all operating on with the same technology and on the same frequency. Very basic. Talk around is we program each other's channels into our radios. Mutual aid is kind of a derivation of that, where we just simply have a a dedicated mutual aid channel that we meet on. Level 4 is gateways or console patches. That is the ability to tie different systems together so that you have people in one system, people in another system. You put a gateway between the two and now allow traffic to flow back and forth between the two. Levels 5 and 6, and the higher you go on this chart, the better is interoperability. Level 5 and 6 are basically the same. Level 5 is a proprietary kind of a system. Everybody's on the same system, but it happens to be proprietary. This is the primary example in Oregon is the metro system of Washington, Clackamas, Multnomah, Portland, Clark County. They're all on a Motorola system. And so since they're all on a common manufacturer system, they all can intercommunicate with each other. Level 6 is a standards-based system where there are technical standards that have been adopted that manufacturers can build to the standards, and you can have anybody's equipment operating on the system or any manufacturer's system tied together. So the higher you go, the more interoperability you have. What we're saying is that on behalf of the state, we need level 6. We need to put all agencies onto a common system, and we need to build up the standards. We don't want to be captive to proprietary purchases for the next 30 years. We just don't want to go there. At the present time, standardized systems are expensive because they're fairly new within the last 5 years. But as time goes on, it's like everything else. When you buy a high-definition television, it's fairly expensive in the beginning, but they become less expensive. And at some point in time, you're not going to be able to buy equipment or a system that is not built to the standard. And what we're suggesting is that level 4 for the rest of Oregon. Level 4 because I did a look at the database, the FCC's database, of public safety licensees within the state of Oregon. There were just over 500 different agencies and jurisdictions listed in that database. I don't think it's possible for Oregon to gather 500 agencies together and put them all onto one system. So, but what we can do is we can recognize that they have valid uses out there. They want to own and operate their own system. They should own and operate their own system. So now let's figure out a way to connect them together. And that's level 4. And this is just a network drawing. The important part of that is that on behalf of the state's portion of this, I think, is the top three levels of this. That's the microwave system that extends throughout the state. It's the network that rides on that microwave system that connects all this stuff together. It is that state level 6 radio system that all state agencies go on. And a byproduct of that to me is that currently between forestry correction or forestry transportation and state police, they each have a fairly large radio system throughout the state, different systems. Department of Corrections has institution-based radio systems. They don't have a statewide system. But those four are pretty well limited to wireless communications in the state. On a consolidated state system, that to me, that opens it up to all state agencies. The agencies that were too small in the past, the Liquor Control Commission, you could name any group out there, Youth Authority, anybody that was too small to be able to do this by themselves will now have, I think, a place, a state system that will support what they have to do also throughout the state. The bottom three layers, the middle one there, interoperability channels, the major downside of gateways is that they only operate in the overlap area. And, for example, if you have a unit in Umatilla County and you have another unit in Morrow County, you can connect the two systems together, and they can operate within their own county, and you connect the two systems together, and they can communicate to get with each other. But now take that Morrow County unit and send that unit over into far eastern Umatilla. if he outran the coverage of the Morrow County system, he doesn't have a way to get into it anymore. You can tie the systems together, but there's no entryway. And so it is the disadvantage of those gateways is they operate in the overlap. What this says is that in order to give the ability for any radio that any Oregon agency has to be able to go statewide, you have to spread that interoperability layer throughout the state. And you can do that using nationwide interoperability and mutual aid channels. So if you take that and spread it across the state, now you can take an 800 megahertz radio out of the city of Portland, send it that unit to Grants Pass. There's an 800 megahertz radio that there sits on the network that gives them an entry point. And so now they can communicate with the local people, and that is true regardless of what kind of radio an agency has and what frequency band they're on. The last two are the federal IWIN system, and that's separate. You know, the reality is that the Integrated Wireless Network is a federal law enforcement radio system. It includes, it is cooperative between federal Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, and Treasury. All of the law enforcement agencies with each one of those departments is on that system. The federal government only started to build that in the state of Washington about 2 years ago. They are now, this spring, will be moving into Oregon. Oregon is only the second state for them to start building this. Their approach to this is that they need state infrastructure. They recognize that they can't build these sites. They can't build the backhaul themselves. That they need state infrastructure to be able to support that system. So they have come to the state. But my first question to them was, good, if you're going to build a system, why can't we use it? Why do we build two systems? Their response was no, that is federal law enforcement only. The system itself will be reserved, at least at this time, for only federal law enforcement. So there will be ways for us to interoperate, but they won't build it strong enough for the states and for locals to be able to actually use it. So it's shown in here as a separate layer, again, of somebody else that we need to connect to. And then the bottom one is that statewide data network, usable by all jurisdictions for data interoperability throughout the whole state.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Along those lines, I mean, basically turf wars, you have that within the state agencies. Do you see there's any problem with the potential turf wars of people being on the same system? They don't seem to want to do that on some occasions.
That has been one of the joys to me over the last several years, and the last year and a half in particular, because we do have the State Wireless Infrastructure Investment Group. That we meet every Thursday morning, half a dozen different state agencies talking about this, and we have agreement that this is the way we're going to go, that we are going to consolidate this, that we are going on to a common system, and that this is what we're going to do. So I have seen absolutely the reverse of acknowledging that this is what we have to do.
So how many agencies, and how does this tie in with the CNEC problem or the CNEC issue?
Well, presently, I think there are only four major radio-owning agencies today.
Okay.
And I keep throwing the military department into there because I know that when this system gets built, one of the major users of it has got to be the military department. It has, when you're talking about a digital kind of a radio system, it is completely secure. It is able to carry national levels of security on it, and so I throw the fifth agency of military in. But then I also throw in the thought of, well, what about emergency medical throughout the state? Right now, that's a hodgepodge of different areas. I think that we also need to be addressing, what do we do about hospital communication? What do we do about ambulance communication we can't handle that kind of stuff day to day, but we can certainly deal with that in a major issue where we all need to be talking with each other. And down at the bottom is shown the tribal, county, metro, city, and districts, that they also, at their option, if they want to, can be tied to this network. But again, this goes along with SWIG's assessment that there is no mandate on anybody. What we know is we have to build, we have to replace the state system, and we have to do that with one system.
And SWIG is?
And that's the State Wireless Investment Group.
That's right.
That is the this Thursday morning consortium of state agencies talking about doing this.
And how many? There was four. How many agencies are in there?
Excuse well, there are four that are radio owning, and there are probably, I'm going to guess, seven or eight that are routinely in the meetings.
Senator Anderson.
No, that's all right.
A follow-up. If the four of you are meeting, I guess two questions in one. What is it that you would want this committee to do? Don't you have the authority to put those four agencies together now?
Yes, we do have that authority, I think, under 2101. What we need is, because we are talking about information management here, the second step in this, we have 6 months of funding from the Emergency Board to fund the consultants to do the plan. We have to come back to you by January of 07 with a completed plan on what this thing costs and what it looks like, and a recommendation to the governor and to the legislature. And so we need to do that planning. We need to get all of it done. So what we need to do is to have support again to the e-board to fund the rest of the biennium for that planning group so we can get that effort done. Right now, we keep talking about $300 million to $500 million. That is totally... I used good data from several states and from a lot of sources to put that together, but it's totally my estimate, and it just to try to put some figure on it. One of the things that we need the engineering group to come back with is a much closer estimate of what this thing is actually going to cost, what it's going to take to do it. And so that's where we're heading with what we need.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How much longer in your presentation until you've concluded? Do you have quite a bit more to do?
It could be over right away if you'd like.
No. I have quite a few questions, and I would like to ask them. Probably better, Mr. Chairman, that I wait until after the presentation is over with.
We'll call on you at the end of the presentation.
Thank you.
One of the things that I look for in interoperability is, this is my vision on what we should arrive at. If within every public safety radio in Oregon, we had channels which just simply said sheriff or state police or whatever we came up with. This list I just put together myself. But if the car, right now, the way we accomplish this is I have to program a radio that says Marion County Sheriff, Malheur County Sheriff, and every one of those is separate. So instead, if it were very simple, it said sheriff. Within the car, keep it simple. But let the system then recognize what has to be done with that. So if a state police trooper from Salem goes to Malheur County on a drug investment, they simply select sheriff. And the system then says, I know where that person is, I know where the vehicle is, and I know who he wants to talk to because he's in Malheur County, and so let me connect him to Malheur. So it takes all of that individual selection out of the car. One of the things I like to point out is you don't drive around the state with your cell phone and a instant book telling you what the channel to dial for a tower. The system sorts all of that out. And that's where these complicated kind of systems have to go. But again, the system can't be programmed only on the basis of what the owner wants done. It's not up to us to tell the county sheriff we're going to have to deliver traffic to you. It's up to the sheriff to say, in Malheur County, I want you to use this channel when that happens. When somebody calls the sheriff, do it this way. And so I look at that as a completely independently driven decision that the SAC, again, needs to work on for interoperability to say that how that's going to work.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative.
Don, quick question in that regard. So OSP then would be on the same system as everyone else would be, but the system would automatically recognize that it was an OSP officer calling, and they would be on a more secure line?
That is
at
correct.
That point? Okay. Thank you.
And it's my view, and I've been around the state, I like to say that I've probably been on every mountaintop in Oregon. I've been around the state a lot, and it's my assessment that the state is not out looking to have to put local governments, counties and cities and districts on this system. But I know that a lot of them, maybe half of them, are just going to say, hey, sign me up. There's no way that we could get the level of communications that you're talking about here by ourselves. And if we're to have interoperability, then that would be the best way to do it. And I think at that time, then we need to look and say, how do we accomplish that? What do the locals have to bring to this? If we're going to add a county on, what do they have to do to make that happen?
Well, Mr. Chair, quick comment regarding that. Don, as you and I have talked about before, me being a longtime firefighter and now a fire board member of a small rural fire district, the ability for us to interface and talk with all of the other, both state and federal agencies, in my case, Sublimity, we sometimes have to do forest fires, and it's nice to be able to talk to everyone on the same frequency. I would think that as this system evolves, that would be a critical component, that the flexibility, the ability to us at the local level to access and be a part of this system is critical, not only for just normal everyday events that we might find ourselves in, but rather for those significant potential events such as Homeland Security events that we may need to participate in at the local level. So having that flexibility, I hope that, again, that's part of the vision here, is that any local government that wants to be a part of that will have the flexibility and the ability to be a part of that. I think that's critical.
I think that's absolutely right in the way that this is heading. Certainly in an interoperability sense, I think you will have that ability because the network recognizes who you are. If in your radio and Sublimity you have a channel that just says ODF, the system is smart enough to know that when Sublimity wants to talk to ODF, who it is that I connect them to. And so that will happen. And the system will sort that out without all the technical problems that we have today to try to make that happen.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm curious, we've been talking about rural. What about the larger metropolitan areas? Do they have the same problems? Or are we talking something entirely different?
No, it is the same problem. It is the same problem in that today, units from the metro area, fire units, police, whatever, a fire unit from the metro area in Portland cannot go outside of the metro area on mutual aid and have communications wherever they go unless they have dual radios in the vehicle or they hand out radios. So the metro areas can't go throughout the rest of the state. The rest of the state can't go in the metro area. But part of this system of systems is to say, how do we solve that? How do we connect those together? And there are ways to do that.
A follow-up to that. Within the metro area, can fire talk to police, police talk to sheriff, sheriff talk to federal agencies. Does that happen in the metro area?
I guess I would look to Chief Johnson. He says yes. The system certainly supports that. Everybody is on the same system, and so it's only a matter of governance then, of saying what units need to talk to whom, and make that happen through the database that controls the whole system. So they can do it. It's a just an excellent. If you were to look at the interoperability of the metro area, it's just excellent.
Now.
Probably
now.
Now. But it doesn't extend outside the metro area, and it doesn't help interoperability at all with the rest of the 95% of the state. Trunking, I want to talk a little bit about that. Trunking is this way of making things more efficient. And it is basically comes from telephone terminology, where in a central office you may have 1,000 different lines, copper lines going out to houses, connecting into that central office. When somebody, one of those 1,000 phones wants to make a telephone call, they connect to the central office. If the other end of the call is within the same central office, it's all handled just by wire, right, through the office. If the call needs to be directed somewhere else, either long distance or to another CO, then there are what are called trunks between between central offices. And there's a limited number. You don't need 1,000 of them, because at any point in time, there are not going to be 1,000 people in the CO who want to talk to 1,000 other people in another CO. It's just statistics and numbers. So there's a smaller number of trunks. And everybody shares those trunks, and it's just a way to get efficiency. This is the common example of a bank and lines, and the fact that you always get in the one that is the longest and the slowest, and that's a conventional access. In trunking, you queue people. You just put them in line and take the next individual resource. Same way with base station transmitters. If you had 4 transmitters there, whoever steps up next gets the next available resource. And I did some statistics for about 5 years in a metropolitan law enforcement agency on the busy hour, which is typically Friday night, 10 o'clock to 2 in the morning, somewhere in there. Busy hour on a patrol district, a 3-second transmission every 3.5 seconds. Just constant with 40 police officers on a channel. Just constant go, go, go. And they line up behind each other. They hear each other, and so they don't talk until the other person finished. But what happens is that you keep queuing people forward into the next teller. And it's the same with radios, that at any given instant, I replaced a system that used 28 different channels, 28 conventional channels, with a trunking system, and that took 15 channels instead of 28 because we trunked, and it took the number of talk groups up 4 times over what we had before. So presently, each agency only has that one talk path. Trunking gives agencies multiple talk paths. You have a fire again in LeGrand. Forestry has availability of multiple talk paths instead of just one. And there's currently very little interoperability between agencies, but interoperability is just programming in a trunking system. The effects of consolidation, everybody gains reliability. At least half of the problem with constructing or reconstructing a radio system is, again, in the buildings, the microwave, and the towers, the basic roadway. I used an example here recently where we were talking about federal funds through Office of Domestic Preparedness and the way that they allocate funds. 80% of the locals sounds like a great idea. But my analogy was, well, how about taking and giving everybody in Oregon a brand new car, but we have no roads? If you don't deal with the infrastructure part of this at some point in time, you can put all this money into interoperability out there at the local level, but you have no, still have no system at the end of the day to make this thing work.
A question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So we're talking about interoperability, but you're saying that the metro areas are pretty much set, and so basically this is outside of basically the Portland area. Is that what we need? Or is Salem all right? Is Medford all right? I need to have a sense of where this $500 million request is for the infrastructure, primarily in central eastern Oregon, southern Oregon, on the coast.
It is across the whole state.
Okay.
It is even across the metro area.
Okay.
Because what you're talking about now is more communications above what the metro has today. So you can't dump the counties and the state agencies into the Portland system. It just would overwhelm it. So you have to build a much smaller layer across the metro area that will handle all of the state interoperability traffic.
Follow up. I like the idea of each county having 95% interoperability of each county, because each county can come up with its needs and the relationships that it can form with the neighboring states, et cetera. And so that's all a part of what you've been talking about at your Thursday morning meetings.
That is correct. And I have a little example of that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Excuse me, just to follow up on that. I mean, we were talking about the infrastructure. I mean, under the 622 bill, we have the telecommunication infrastructure. Explain to us, can that be used? Is that entirely different? How are you guys viewing that?
I think there is some, certainly that is one part of it. Any fiber that exists, any networks that exist, one of the things you have to be very careful about when we talk about the network on this, we're talking about a completely closed, it happens to use internet protocol, but it is not the internet. It is completely divorced from outside connections so that you have no hackers, you have no, when you need it, it is there, it is available, it has the quality of service that you need. Typically, we would look at a network that is built to a grade of service that would say no more than one time out of 100 would there not be a teller at the bank. That when you want to talk, and when you have a public safety communication, and you need to talk, that at least 99 times out of 100, there is a resource for you. I did statistics again on that 15-channel trunking system, and over 6 months with 4,000 users on that system, there were only two times when all of the resources, all 15 channels were used, and in no case did that last more than 2 seconds. And so that's, in an engineering sense, that's what you have to do. You have to say, how many of these stations do I need to have in order to have that kind of reliability and accessibility for not only routine, but emergency.
Just a follow-up.
Follow-up question.
I mean, you've got this system on the fiber optic system, and as I understand, there's excess capacity on it. Isn't there any possible way to use that in this whole thing? I mean, you've got the redundancy, the backhaul, and everything already in place for probably 90% of the state.
There certainly is an opportunity to use that, and I think that that's going to be I don't want to say a major component, but I think a component. The reality is that if you look at a significant amount of fiber that goes down the I-5, it's good end-to-end. In order to connect Salem to Medford, that's a great use, a very reliable use. But it doesn't drop off at Harness Mountain at Cottage Grove. It doesn't go to all of the places that you need to go. So where it does go, a great resource. It's, I think, going to be a critical component of tying this whole thing together to make it all work.
Question. I'm looking at a scope and size question. We talk about public safety, and then we talked about other agencies. I have a preconceived notion of public safety. It's people that respond to an emergency. How would these other agencies come into the game then, after we have the state police in, the sheriff, metropolitan police, those Red Cross, those sorts of people? How do we get these other agencies into the game? Under what definition?
Well, first of all, I guess there's kind of a subgroup within public safety, which is first responders, which is the traditional fire, police, emergency medical, some ambulance kind of first response. And then there is public safety. And the definition of public safety traditionally includes transportation, because if the snow isn't removed, there's no emergency vehicle moving. And so they are within public safety. Forestry conservation is within public safety. So there's a much broader category of what public safety is. We also, I think, in when we talk about interoperability, we need to include all phases of it. And we also need to include the ability for public service utilities. In a major storm, you have to be able to communicate with them as well. So when you're talking about setting up an interoperability system, I think you have to broaden the scope and say, who is it that we're going to need to communicate within in these emergencies, and how can they access this system, or how can we connect to them when we need to talk to them? This is a site down near Springfield, and when I show this, I always say that there's as much water inside that building as out. The state police transmitter inside is draped in a plastic sheet to keep the water from running on it. And this is the kind of stuff that you can't do. There is an emergency generator within the building itself that managed to break an exhaust pipe 2 years ago and filled the whole room with soot. And so everything in there was virtually annihilated. An example of a good facility. This is one that was built. It's a consortium of Polk County, Yamhill County, and OSP. It's up in West Hills on Eagle Crest. And this is an example of a well-engineered, sustainable, reliable facility. The bad part about that is that, to my knowledge, there are only 9 of these in the state. There are 8 of them in CSEP in Umatilla Morrow, because the federal government paid to build this kind of facility over there. The only other one that I know of that exists is this one. And so the other system, the other facilities throughout the state are not built like this. They are not able to, they don't have the reliability that you have to have in emergency service. And I'll skip through that. In an engineering sense, what I specify is that a tower has to be strong enough to withstand, with the loads that we say are on it, with all the antennas that are on it, 120 mile an hour winds, and if the tower has a half inch of radial ice on it, give it the worst possible thing, because that's what's going to happen. And if the tower is not built to that, then it's going to be laying on the ground, or there's going to be antennas all over the ground, and everything's going to be out. But I think when we build this state infrastructure, we also need to build it with an eye to putting local governments in there to the extent that we can. Local government ought to be able to go into that. And it ought to be, and I believe a I did a work on a contract with the state of Washington. It's a 16-state purchasing contract. And the tower specifications say that ultimately you could have up to 3 cellular companies on the same tower. And so what that does is it guarantees that the tower is built strong enough to be able to handle multiple kind of loads. And if you think about that, you know, that might be one way to spur universal cell phone access across the whole state. The buildings themselves, there are some technical things that have to happen with grounding and power. Generator, one of the big things they had in Katrina, they ran out of fuel and they were unable to fuel them. Our goal is to make a site have enough fuel on site to be able to keep it running for 2 weeks. There's not much we can do past that, but if we can keep it up for 2 weeks, then that gives us a likelihood at least to be able to get fuel delivery onto the site if we have a power outage longer than that. This is an example of a very good facility, reliable facility. This is the equipment inside.
I don't want to push you too hard, but we do have several other speakers, and we do have some questions from Representative Krupp. Are there some other major points you'd like to get over quickly, and then I'm going to...
I'll run very quickly through these. This is the ODF radio system, 55 sites, 96 ODOT, 103 at state police, composite of 171 sites that the state owns. Through consolidation, that number is going to be reduced. And again, I went back and used the Wallowa County. There are 2 used by ODF, 2 different ones by state police, 2 different ones by ODOT. And if we look at what can be done, this is the most interesting. It shows that you not only get a lot more coverage of Wallowa County, but in the process, we're able to remove 2 state sites. You're able to use 3 from the state, 2 from the county, and 1 from the state of Idaho. And so by looking at it in an engineering sense, consolidation can have a much better use of the resource. And I didn't particularly choose this example for what would happen, but it was interesting that by using counties and 2 state sites, everybody participated in a lot less cost to everybody. Integrated wireless network, we'll start working on that in the spring, probably in April. We'll be working with the federal government. They basically are funding the state rebuild of 12 facilities along Interstate 5. So they'll fund upgrading the buildings, putting in digital microwave systems, those things. In the end, the state owns all the equipment and all the sites. The only thing that the federal government has is responsibility for maintaining its own radio equipment. But because they need the service, they need the space from us, and they need the microwave, they'll pay for that. The consulting services that we're trying to conclude right now, a contract on that, is again to come back with the conceptual designs for all of this to the next legislature. Say not only specifically what it is, but what do we expect it will cost, and a lot more accurate cost than what I was able to provide. And we're right in the process now of putting several people loaned by various agencies and 3 limited duration positions into OEM to work on this. Why do we have to do that if we're hiring a consultant? Because we have to be at least as smart as they are. When they come back at the end of a year and say what it is that they think we're going to do, we better know that what they're saying is correct. And so it's our job over the year to work with them in supplying information that on behalf of the state, and then at the end of the time be able to say that what they've given us is correct and to make a recommendation on behalf of the state. That's it.
Representative Krupp, you had some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don, a couple of questions to start with here. SAFECOM is a spinoff of Homeland Security, correct?
That is correct.
And you have adopted, I see in the strategic plan, a number of their recommendations?
That is correct.
One of those is the utilization of P25 technology, correct?
That is correct.
Is P25 the only technology out there that is capable of achieving what it is that we need to achieve here in Oregon?
P25 is the only standard. If we are, there are other technologies that we could look at that are proprietary, that are not built to standards, that are completely unique to a manufacturer. There are some of those technologies out there. But if we step into the standards arena, P25 is the only standard. And it has an advantage not only in that it is an existing standard, but that process is right now looking at not only the standard today, but the next two generations. So they recognize that at some point in time, you're going to need to migrate these systems to something else, and they're standardizing those as well.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Follow.
So, I mean, P25's technology has been around quite a while now. It would seem logical to me that the incredible explosion in technology that we've had, that there ought to be another standard out there and technology that is more advanced. Or are you saying that P25, as it exists as a technology, is upgradable and scalable to the future?
That's the issue. It is upgradable and scalable. And the problem is that right today, if we were to put a P25 system in to replace existing systems, we can do that using the same sites. There is a European standard called TETRA, which has some major advantages to it, but I'll give an example. In the UK, a nationwide TETRA system took 2,200 sites. Because it's a cellular kind of technology, and it's every 5 miles is another site. Project 25 doesn't do that. Project 25 uses the same power level, same coverage patterns that we use today. So it's a way to get into the standardized digital systems at the most economical that you can do it today. But P25 is looking at, well, they're about a year away from adoption of the next generation standard, which will be to say, how do we get faster speeds, how do we do more within the family of standards.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Follow up.
P25, it's my understanding that some P25 vendors, even though there's a standard, the compatibility is not 100% there. One of my concerns would be that if we're going to use P25 standard, that, I mean, we have how many pieces of equipment here? OSP's got 1,300 mobiles and portables, forestry 3,000, correction 3,000, ODOT 4,500. It's a lot of pieces of equipment, not to mention us at the local level. How do we know that if we use P25 technology, that everybody's going to buy the same equipment and we're going to be compatible?
It's a great question, because this is reality. This is what's happened to us over the last several years. These radios are computers that you happen to talk through, and there are startup problems with getting them to talk to each other. The federal government has recognized that difficulty, that although manufacturers each build equipment to the standard, that they still won't talk to each other. And so the federal government is right now setting up their National Institute of Science and Technology, NIST, out of Colorado, to develop what they call conformance testing, where they will develop the process that third-party testing laboratories then will use to make sure that all manufacturers' equipment actually talks to each other. So it will be up to the manufacturers then to take their radio to the conformance lab, run it through that, and then when what rolls out of there is fully able to talk to each other. It not only meets the standard, but they actually talk to each other. So that process, we're probably about 9 months away from having the conformance test done by the federal government.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So what you're saying is that P25 is the standard that gives us the most bang for the buck, or is there new technology that's actually cheaper that will still do this for us?
P25 is the only standard. Now, if we one of the problems is that you could remain in an analog world today. You could not convert to a digital system. You could remain in analog. But the analog systems will not meet the next generation of the FCC mandate. So you buy yourself maybe 7 years of time by remaining back in analog, but at the end of 7 years you have to do it all over again. Where the P25 systems are standardized, more efficient, and they will meet the FCC mandates.
And Mr. Chairman, last question. So the P25 system is a standardized system, and what you're saying that we're not going to do is by adopting a P25 standard, we're not going to subject ourselves to a proprietary non-open system. Okay, we're going to open it up so that P25 will be able, so that if I'll just throw a name out. If Motorola has a set of radios that Sublimity Fire wants to buy, and Jeff Johnson wants to use another manufacturer, because it's P25 technology, that in the future they're going to be able to talk to each other. And so even though we're on the same interoperability network someday, if Jeff's fire crew and my fire crew's out working on a fire somewhere across Oregon on a mutual aid agreement, that we can actually talk to each other.
That is correct.
Across different makers of equipment.
That is correct.
Okay.
And along the way, you have not limited yourself to sole source purchases
right.
from anybody. That you go open competitive bid. Every time you want to buy more equipment, you go open competitive bidding and get the best price and the best equipment that you can get. Because it's built as a standard.
But again, Mr. Chair, so that I establish what I thought I heard you say, the problem today is that not all the manufacturers of P25 equipment, not all of their equipment is 100% compatible, but that the federal government is working on a mandate that all of the manufacturers have to make it compatible 100%? Is that right?
That is correct. They will have to certify that their equipment meets conformance tests, that they actually do work together. And it's not anything sinister on behalf of industry. It is each one of them builds their equipment to the standard. But it's a matter of interpretation to engineers what that meant. And so they implement it a little bit differently, and in the end you get it out and they won't talk to each other. So now the federal government has stepped in and say, hey, hold it, we're going to make everybody look at this in the same exact way so that you all have the same assumptions. And then when you get these things in the field, they'll talk to each other.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions?
Next speaker.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And Madam Chairman, or Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Don's slides will be available to you. We'll either email them or send them to you in the next few days for your
excellent.
Reference.
Thank you, Don.
Is
Chair Dowell, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management. And as you heard earlier, House Bill 2101 moved this entire project into Oregon Emergency Management. So my to-do list got larger. I know our time is short, and I'll be very brief. I just do want to point out that House Bill 2101 did require us in the Office of Emergency Management to submit three reports on the progress of this plan and then a final plan. The first one was due on or before November 30th. I think we just made it. And then the next one is June 30th of 2006, and then a final report to the governor and the legislature by January 12th, on or before that date, 2007. So, yes, we will be back, and as you can see, it's complicated. It's very technical, and there's not many Don Foles in the world, unfortunately. Although Don has been, you know, we go to night school with Don, and he's training us. And these Thursday morning meetings that we've had for well over a year now, we've learned a lot. So a couple things. Again, time is short. In your package, you'll see a little colored chart with some positions, and I just wanted to orient you briefly to that. You've heard from various speakers already that we did go before the October Emergency Board, and we did acquire some money on a six-month basis, and you can see by the color coding, the pink ones is where the money was approved, and we're also using Homeland Security funds to help support this effort. And then we also have some cooperative agreements with the Oregon State Police, Department of Transportation, and the Department of Administrative Services. So we really are trying to exemplify good partnerships and how to make the best use of the money that we do have. And you can see that the State Police is loaning Don Full to this project, and we do have himself and two other people that are working now, as he had mentioned, you know, to be as smart as the people that we're going to hire to do the design of this, or recommended design to us. ODOT, we currently have a job application out on the street to help manage this section, and not necessarily from the technical point, but as to manage the operations as this section begins to grow. As Don briefed earlier, you know, our plan, as the agencies have agreed, that we will merge these groups of people that work on the systems together eventually into one cooperative section that can work on all of the different sites for this one communication system for the entire state police. So that vacant position, as you look at on the top right, is the one that ODOT currently has out for advertisement, and that will be that person that will take care of the beginning of the management of more internal issues, dealing with labor unions, how to bring the groups together, space and facilities to work in, vehicles, all the technical details that it will take to maintain this system. And so this group, the people that are here currently have begun work, and as Mr. Full mentioned, that we are about ready to get a contractor that will work on the initial design recommendations for us of this system. So we will be coming back to this committee to continue to brief and answer your questions. And I know, as anyone that will brief you today, you know, once you see the PowerPoint and have some more time to absorb it, we'll be able to answer any of your questions. And I know the State Interoperability Executive Council discusses this frequently, so Senator Metzger will obviously have some insight that he can help with. I do want to diverse real quick back and just assure Senator Nelson, I talk to Fred Zaire quite often, and even though I don't understand it, I think it's pretty cool stuff. And if you ever do get a chance, and I hope, I'm pretty sure Senator Nelson would advocate this, I think it would do us all good, and I would suspect Fred would even come here and give a demonstration. Although I have challenged Mr. Zaire to do what he did in Eastern Oregon, considering the geography in Eastern Oregon is a little bit different than someplace like Wallowa County, or Douglas County, but it is a good system, and I think TSA has recognized that, obviously, by the fact that they're giving them money. That's always a good indicator. And I think there's another exciting project that, as we work with Mr. Zaire, and it's really all about Wi-Fi. And you see a lot of that terminology be thrown around the nation, and still, to the best of my knowledge, Oregon has the largest Wi-Fi hotspot in the world, and that's over in eastern Oregon in Senator Nelson's area. So we're actually competing, Senator. We're going to try and Wi-Fi the entire Columbia Gorge, and we're doing that, and that's part of the project that he alluded to earlier, and it's a cooperative project, really starting out with the maritime industry, and we're moving it to the Corps of Engineers, Union Pacific Railroad, Oregon Department of Transportation, and so forth. So anyway, I just want to assure you that we're keeping a close eye on his inventions and technologies and looking at that. So I won't take any more time. I think we still have some other speakers to go through. We're building this section, Oregon Emergency Management, and we will be back to provide you updates and, of course, help you at any time.
Sure.
Try to answer some of the questions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you, Kim. Senators.
Thank you. Ken, could you explain the relationship between the approval of the emergency board of $174,000 and the loan positions that have seemingly filled out your team here?
Chair Dallum, Senator Morse, the team has been brought together. The money that we needed was to really fill in such things as supply and services and the things that to fill in for salaries that we couldn't pay for through loan positions. And so that's the money that we got from the emergency board. And it was a six-month trial. Yeah. Yeah, and it's also to be able to hire the expertise that we need, to be able to look at the designs and work through those with a vendor once they're brought on board.
So as a follow-up.
Follow-up.
The remainder of the total request being $893,000 is still determined to be funds that are needed?
Well, we've gone back and of course working with legislative fiscal and Mr. Wilson, we'll keep looking at this. Some of the savings we were able to do by doing some of these loans from ODOT and other agencies, but we will eventually have to recalculate the figures and as to what we will need for salaries of different positions, supplies and services, and that type of thing.
Chair, if I might just add to that, I don't see that number going down significantly. What that represents is the remainder of the biennia for the people that we've been able to bring on board. We received 6 months' worth of funding to take us until May the 31st of 2006, and so we would need the remainder of funding for personnel and then also the service and supplies, which would include travel to the various tower sites and the work that the individuals, not only that were hired, but also the loaned individuals have to do, too.
Thank you.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All of these consolidated sites that we're going to develop as part of this plan, who's going to own them and maintain them? If this is one network, we have OSP has 106 sites, ODOT 136, Forestry 60. Will those agencies continue to own and maintain those sites, even though everyone's going to be using them? How are we going to sort that out?
I think that is, and I'll defer to any of my colleagues, I think that's something that we will have to sort out. Depends on how many we can actually consolidate on each mountaintop, who actually owns them. And as we experienced in Umatilla and Morrow counties when we did the chemical stockpile program, it's absolutely phenomenal who owns a piece of earth on top of a mountaintop and how legal it is versus a handshake 50 years ago. And so I think a lot of those issues of ownership, and I think the ultimate goal is whatever will facilitate the best interest of the state and the owner of the land where the tower and the buildings may set will probably be the ultimate answer. But that'll be something that has to be sorted out in the long run. And I think, and Don back being up on this, the different agencies that own sites right now, some of them are actually owned, some are leased. We're borrowing space on other towers because somebody already had the majority of the mountaintop taken up.
And Mr. Chair, one final question.
Follow up.
And with equipment, individual agencies purchasing equipment, will there be one big equipment purchase for all agencies to use, or will there be each individual agency buying equipment and then coming to us at the legislature and asking for authority to do that kind of thing? What can we expect here?
Chair Dallin, Representative Krupp, it is our intent and goal as we move along into this system to get away from that type of thing where each individual agency has to come purchase a single thing. I think that's been a product of stovepipe systems over the last many years here in the state, and if consolidating this group into one functional organized body and dealing with the issues, we'll be able to purchase equipment on a statewide level that will support all the agencies and all the systems. And we will get away from that type of thing. And I think ultimately, too, as Chief Johnson mentioned, you know, if we have individual jurisdictions that come onto the system, we may be able to even help them in a consolidated purchase fashion also. And we've learned that through Homeland Security, being able to purchase multiple things for multiple jurisdictions at the state level.
Yes, Ken, as you and I had an opportunity to visit some time ago about a system that is all-inclusive. What is the incentive to, besides a purchase incentive for the counties, local agencies, first responders, that sort of thing, what is their incentive to participate?
Chair Dallum, I think there are actually quite a few incentives as time goes on. One, depending on what type of system a jurisdiction currently owns, you know, this may allow them, if they so choose, you know, to come onto the system and use it for interoperability purposes, where they may not necessarily, that would keep them from going out and purchasing a brand new system for themselves. Subsequent to what we've talked about today, through Homeland Security efforts, you know, the first few years of Homeland Security, we were just buying stuff. And now we've required counties and jurisdictions to come in with plans on communications. So between Homeland Security and the State Interoperability Executive Council, we have the ability then to look at what these groups are doing so that we can encourage them, number one, and tell them how to save money. But I think a lot of this will be an incentive also, as we talked earlier, and Representative Krupp, coming onto this system, too, gives a first responder a greater sense of reliability if they have to move somewhere else in the state to operate, which is the case in many occasions, then they have that incentive that they have a reliable system. The safety of their firefighters and law enforcement officers are better off. They also, coming onto this system, have the incentive, if we ever do get to one of those really bad situations, that you have the security to be able to send video and data and voice over a secure system where you know that, you know, the rest of the world can't see it or hear it. And so, and especially I think with jurisdictions that may not have the financial stability to set something up on their own, I mean, this really offers them an opportunity. And I would like to also think, too, as you and I learned in our trip to Fossil, that we might be able to work with other entities, education service districts, cell phone companies, that not only for them, but maybe even for the state to be an incentive to work together, as we learned what it took to get cell phones in Fossil, that there really are incentives as long as you get all the groups together. And I think the local jurisdictions will see a lot of these incentives start to blossom, and a good example is at the chemical stockpile program. Once we put in the 450 megahertz system, and then Mr. Fred Zaire and his company Easy Wireless added all those cool toys to it, it was really oriented at public safety, but all of a sudden all other portions of local government and special districts learned that there are some absolutely time-saving, cost-effective ways to use this system for other things than public safety, more efficient in records, more efficient in data transfer, and some of it wasn't even planned. It just happened by accident, which usually is a good way because other people will see the benefit of it, and it will become a very productive system.
Thank you, Ken. Are there any other questions for Mr. Murphy? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, we are in subcommittee. Now that we have a quorum, would now be the appropriate time to go ahead and look at the rules since we have everyone here and at least
get have we pretty much finished this agenda?
We have two hopefully short presentations more to finish this agenda item, and then I would suggest that would probably be an appropriate time.
Thank you.
So we'll take these two and then we'll get right to rules.
Chair Dallin, members of the committee, my name is Christy Wild. I'm the 911 manager for Central Land Communications in Eugene, and I represent Oregon APCO NENA, which is the Association for Public Safety Communications Managers, Dispatchers, and 911 Call Takers. I'm here as the chair of the SIEC Strategic Planning Committee, and I was planning on having Sheriff Jim Swinyard with me today, but he chairs the Partnership Committee and was unable to be here because of a conflict with the Sheriff's Association. I think we'll be able to cover some of the things that he would have talked about. What I would like to do is give you a brief, high-level overview of the evolution of the SIEC strategic planning process, and you have a copy of the strategic plan in your packet, as well as talk a little bit about our current priorities. As you've heard, the SIEC was established by Governor's Executive Order in 2002, and then was codified into state law through the passage of House Bill 2101 during the 2005 Legislative Assembly. The one thing I'll read is our mission for you: to develop recommendations for policy and guidelines, to identify technology and standards, and coordinate intergovernmental resources to facilitate statewide wireless communications interoperability with an emphasis on public safety. Now, that's a mouthful. But when we got together to start working on our planning process, it was really quite simple. We sat down and said, what are the critical issues around interoperability, and went from there. And our critical issues were, number one, we needed to be able to talk to one another in major incidents and in day-to-day operations. We knew that we would need to leverage limited funding. And to do that, we wanted to eliminate duplication by resource sharing and also by bridge building across jurisdictions. That was very important. There was a need for functional guidelines, both operational and technical, for interoperability. What does an interoperable system look like? How are decisions made? And by the way, how in the world are we going to meet the mandates from the FCC for the 2013 system upgrades? We recognized that there was a lack of central coordination, guidance, and governance for interoperability. Everybody was talking about it after September 11th, but there wasn't an easy place to go for assistance, for resources, for information. And then lastly, time criticality. The SIEC was formed shortly after the September 11th attacks. And we wanted to, as a state, we had been working on preparing ourselves for dealing with major incidents, but what we wanted to do was effectively and aggressively address our ability or lack thereof to communicate with one another when and where we needed to. So, our strategic goals have essentially remained the same throughout this planning process. They center on leadership and planning, on technology, both planning and purchasing thoughtfully, and then finally on collaborative partnerships. And there's more in the plan if you want to get information about that. But what I'd like to move to next is to talk about some of the major accomplishments that we have already, accomplishments that we've already made in our nearly 4 years of existence, because we're very proud of how much we've done already. The first thing we did was we defined the leadership structure to support interoperability, and in doing that, got the consensus of the Oregon public safety community. The council is represents keep local, state, tribal, and even the military public safety entities, and we're talking together and planning together, collaborating all the time. We wanted to make sure that our priorities were well placed, so one of the first things we did was we contracted for an inventory and gap analysis of radio systems within Oregon. And a big surprise for me, I heard TURP come out earlier. I was expecting to see that relationships were a primary obstacle to interoperability planning, but finances across the board, financing was one of the key issues. We put together publications and tools for partner governments, and in those there was a guide for short-term strategies for achieving interoperability. It was a how-to list that anybody could pick up and understand and start working on in their area. We set out guidelines for being more successful in acquiring equipment that would build interoperability capabilities through the Department of Homeland Security grant process. We applied for and successfully were approved for a project that linked key jurisdictions along the I-5 corridor through gateway devices so that we were more able to communicate with one another, keeping in mind an incident that happened, I think, in the last 10 years, a kidnapping that started in the metro area and went down and ended in Roseburg. Jurisdictions would, once this project is completed, would be able to talk to one another as they passed down the I-5 corridor. Finally, the formation of the State Wireless Infrastructure Investment Group, which you've heard referred to as SWIG, and that is our basis for the system of systems. As we were studying and talking about the importance of agencies being interoperable, here we were faced with four separate state agencies that were not connected, that needed to be replaced and upgraded, and were better to start the model of how to work together than with the state system. In June of 2005, we passed five policy actions that have been folded into the plan and pretty much are the roadmap for one of our deliverables, the interoperable communications plan that you'll be hearing more from us about in the future. The first policy action was for the system of systems, and this was our position to promote a linking of disparate systems together, not completely building one system that everybody would use, but to take critical infrastructure that already existed and build out from there and use gateway devices to tie them together. The next thing that we agreed upon was that we would work to achieve a level 4 interoperability statewide. Now, that also depends on gateway devices, and we are not discouraging anybody from going higher than that. In the Portland metropolitan area, they are working for a level 6 system with shared standards. In my home county, Lane County, we are also working on that. But we felt that level 4 was achievable and reasonable and a good goal. The statewide platform for agencies to use for interoperable purposes is tying the four state radio systems together and building it in a way that makes it easy for other radio systems, such as my county, to join on. The fourth policy action that we agreed upon was the virtual private network access for all public safety agencies, that this would be engineered and constructed in a way that would encourage others to participate so that we wouldn't have silo systems out there. We know that we need to build a system that allows people to talk to one another. The statewide system is the one where it makes sense. And then finally, encouraging but not requiring co-location of facilities. In the project that's going on in Lane County, we already have a radio site that we are planning to work on together and have been for a while with the state, where we are sharing costs, sharing space. There's a limited number of mountaintops where you can get good radio reception, and it's not a very popular land use. It's really important to try to share those whenever possible. It makes sense for many reasons. Anyway, those have been the major accomplishments that we've been working on. And I'd like to just finish by talking about the deliverables that we have coming as a result of the passage of House Bill 2101. The first is the statewide interoperable communications plan. And I told you that these policy actions will be the backbone for that. And then secondly is the system that you've been hearing about for the replacement of the state radio system. That was very brief. I'll answer any questions that you have, but I would also refer you back to the strategic plan.
Question, Mr. Chair. And I read this in the Oregonian some time ago, so I might have my facts a little bit mixed up here, but Homeland Security, at least from the feds, had sent quite a bit of money here, and according to this article, we were not maximizing the use, or we had used very little. That kind of funding are we able to use for systems like this? I mean, I would think that we would, and I was wondering if that article is true, why haven't we accessed those funds?
Department of Homeland Security funds have been a part of this process, have helped us to get to where we are today. The project I referred to where we're linking through gateway devices, the I-5 corridor, came from Department of Homeland Security funds, staff assistance in our planning efforts. There's pieces, the different systems that we'll be linking to this system, all of those have come through Department of Homeland Security funds. One of the other things that we've done is to try to help steer agencies by saying, here's the priorities when you're applying for your funding, and it deals with communications equipment, so that we will all be able to work better together as a result of the way that money was used. The money will not be coming in the same amounts that we've seen it in the past. We recognize that. And I know that you heard we're talking about looking at earmarks also. And John will be addressing that more, but, yeah.
Okay.
Well, one of the questions that I have, we talk about putting together 911, and previously Don talked about a percentage of the state. If you were to draw a shaded area on the map, what percentage of the state is connected through 911? 95%, 80%?
The state is 100% connected through 911, enhanced 911 for the hardwired telephones. We're still working on that phase two location information for cellular, but we have 911 border to border in this state.
So we do have one system in place that goes everywhere.
The really cool thing is that people can, when they need emergency help, they can call 911 and someone will answer and they'll be treated similarly across the state. What we're trying to address is now we need to send the responders out into the field and have them be able to coordinate the actual incident. So 911 is access to the system. The radio infrastructure is how the first responders communicate once the incident is in progress.
So if you have phone service, you can get to 911.
Yes, you can.
Secret is phone service.
I would qualify that, Chair Dallin, because there's a new type of phone service that you may have heard referred to as voice over internet, VoIP. And there are major issues with those VoIP phone service providers. It's just a different way of delivering the phone service. And the FCC is mandating right now that they make 911 access available through their service. That is an issue that we're dealing with separate from this radio system.
Any other questions?
Okay, I'll turn this over to John.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Kresge, Assistant Director for General Services with the Department of Corrections. I'm also the chair of the Finance Committee, a subgroup of the SIEC. This morning, what I want to do is very briefly, and I can do this very briefly because our committee really is just formed. We've had three meetings over the last 3 months. Talk to you about what we've done to date and a little bit about what we're planning to do in the future. We developed a Finance Committee charter, which was approved by the full SIEC in July of this year. That charter established our scope, which essentially says that we're there to create a capital finance strategy plan that will satisfy the debt service requirements for construction of an interoperable statewide communication system. That's the infrastructure and radio systems, the investments in those, as well as create a financing plan to support the ongoing operation of the interoperable statewide public safety communications network. The committee formed. We had our first meeting in September, and the committee does include a cross-section of the wireless community that includes both local as well as state partnerships. We initially worked on a policy statement, which the intent was to really set the parameters around which we were going to do our work that we just recently had adopted by the full SIC. And some of this is going to sound a little redundant, but in terms of what other presenters have already talked about. But why don't we just go through that very quickly. You should have a copy of that in the packet. I think it was provided to you. It reiterates that we are taking the systems-to-systems approach that will result in an integrated wireless communication system that will have compatible gateways. We recognize that financing will come from a variety of sources, including federal, state, and local participation. And that local participation will be voluntary. I hope that we're able to build something that folks will look at and say it makes sense for us to put our investment in as opposed to trying to do something separate. The committee will develop will recommend the full SAC financing model that will support both the initial build as well as the ongoing operation. And that federal grant funding will be for the interoperability system will be a primary focus for us. And that finally, the partnership the committee that Christie's involved in will be responsible for ensuring that communication with all stakeholders as this project moves along. We have conducted some preliminary research looking into how other states have funded construction and ongoing operations. And what we found is that it's a combination of a lot of things. No one state has done it exactly the same, and there's no silver bullet out there. So we're going to have to kind of take as much information as we can from as many sources and figure out what works best for the state of Oregon. But what we found is that it's a combination of state budget appropriations, federal dollars through state grants and direct appropriations, development of partnerships with federal agencies, and consolidating existing dollars. Some have chosen to increase fees for things like vehicle and voter registration, redirection of emergency 911 surcharges, and then direct partnerships with our subscribers or people at the local level charging some kind of a fee. So what we've done to date, in addition to developing that policy and doing some research and analysis, is that we have taken a look at one finance model, and that's the Department of Forestry's model, to look to see whether or not that's a, and we have chosen that as kind of a starting point for us as a model, a straw model, if you will, to bring that in, start to do a little more detailed work on some of the cost stuff that Don went over earlier, the cost of the system, the initial build-out, as well as that ongoing cost, you know, all the components that fit into that. Get a little better idea about what state agencies are currently spending on their wireless infrastructure, as well as get maybe a little bit better feel about what we think that the subscriber, the participation case will be, particularly from the local community. Obviously, all the state agencies, the four primary that you've heard about today, are going to be a participant in this infrastructure piece. But in order to get to some kind of fee base, we're going to have to do some extrapolation and figure out what are the likely folks that will be joining from the local communities to be joining in this infrastructure. So we're going to do a little more work over the next couple of months, honing down that information. Then we're going to take that information and apply it to the model as a starting point and to start taking a look at, okay, this is what we think the cost may be, this is what we think the participation might be. What are some of the holes we have to fill in? What are those likely sources then of income or of revenue that we can bring in that will then start to form the recommendations that we'll bring forward to the SIC? That concludes my remarks this morning. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I think that is the completion of this item. I expect that they will be making a request probably in January to the emergency board. We will bring that specific request back to this committee at its January meeting for the formal approval. I did not hear any real problem with any of the approaches being taken here. I think there were a few questions, a few items that probably they need to address and maybe bring back in the January meeting, and I'll work with them on that. But in terms of where they're headed, I did not see any disagreement or angst or anything coming from the committee, and I hope that is my observations were correct in that.
I'm looking for shaking. Get in there.
I think we're still trying.
No, we're choking.
Sorry.
With that, I think we're Dallas.
Good.
We were going to have a panel co-chair.
That's right. Don't we? And you, it's your show. Unless you want to.
Well, we need the quorum, and Representative Cole should be right in. You want me to briefly go over the two sets of rules? You have, Mr. Chairman, you have the schedule for the meetings, the scheduled meetings here on out. They're under your tab number one. Will be the Tuesday of the emergency board week. It's quite often a number of the requests that come in. We need a recommendation from this committee to the emergency board. You have two different sets of draft rules under tab one. The first one is just labeled draft version number one. It says a quorum shall be comprised of a majority of the members of each chamber. The second draft, it says a quorum shall be comprised of a majority of the appointed members. And then the two rules, and they vary only in that respect. That one would require action be taken by a quorum, which would be under draft one of a majority of the members of each chamber, which would then require three from each chamber to constitute a quorum versus just a total of five, as there are nine members.
Tell us, do you want to take questions as we go, or would you rather... When the co-chair and I got together, we'd like a past practice. What has that been?
Past practice, with the exception of last interim, it was a majority of appointed members constituted a quorum. That's what the enabling legislation for this committee says, that quorum shall be a majority of the appointed members. However, last session, the committee, because of the leadership situation, they wanted a quorum to be a majority of both chambers. And so last, with the exception of last biennium, or the last interim, it's the quorum has been a majority of the appointed members. The statute can be is a guideline, but the Mason's Manual, I think, allows you to adopt something different. The rules allow that. The committee, by law, has seven members, but leadership has chosen to expand it by one member on each chamber, so you have nine. Mm-hmm. So you have some flexibility, I believe.
If I might, Senator Nelson, you were chair last time. Did this present? Do you know any reason for changing the past practice?
Well, I think it was because we were in the
split
15-15, and that's as I recall it.
Did you have any issues that became an issue, House and Senate?
No, I don't recall it even coming up in the discussion. We just adopted the rules, as I remember it. I don't think anybody even questioned it at that time that there was a change. I don't remember it at all, but it was an issue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think I do, in a joint committee like this, I think I do see the value, though, of having a quorum from each house. And the reason is that sort of, it's a checks and balances kind of system. The Senate can't move something through this committee without the help of the House, and the House can't move something through the committee without the help of the Senate. And I think the two bodies working together in that respect makes a quorum requirement from each body somewhat beneficial. It can also be a pain in the backside because, like we faced this morning, you were stuck in the gorge, and Representative Krupp was stuck in Eugene, and so we were without enough House members to be able to carry on or to be able to adopt. Actually, I guess we could have adopted rules because the rules hadn't been there was no decision yet. But I think that. There was a quorum in that respect because there were a majority of members here. But I think that it does and can lead to the sort of both chambers being equally involved with decisions that are coming out of the body or out of the committee. So I would. My suggestion is that we stay with what we did last interim, and that there be a majority of members from each house.
Mr. Chair, I concur.
Mr. Chair, I move that we accept the rules draft number one, which requires that we need a majority of House members and a majority of Senate members before we move any action.
Should I call this meeting order first?
Yes.
We're in subcommittee.
Oh, yeah,
you Yes, you are.
That's right.
I am so tickled. For a whole year, Dallas kept me straight, and this is the first time.
The Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology will come to order and is in session. Now we would entertain you.
I move that we accept the rules, the draft number one rules, in which this you need a majority of Senate members and a majority of House members before action can be taken.
And that would constitute a quorum.
Constitute a quorum. Yeah, sorry.
And if you're looking for a second, Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead and second that. I don't, we don't really have to have a second, but I will certainly.
I'm just looking down at the second. We have a motion on the table. Are there any questions? If not, all those in favor, the clerk will call the roll. Say aye, and those opposed, say no.
Caught her by surprise.
Yeah.
Caught me by surprise. I'm running.
You want to look at our names here? We just had a...
Here, we'll turn them.
I'm running the Kiwanis meeting right now.
Okay, Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative
Crump?
Aye.
Representative Morris?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Nelson?
Aye.
Senator
Dahl.
Hi. Did she say Senator Dahl?
She demoted you, demoted you however you looked at it.
Was that a promotion or demoted
you? Senator Farioli. Sure.
We're not in the majority.
Welcome.
Okay, we now have rules. And we can move forward.
Now we can actually do stuff.
Dallas, will you take us through our computing network infrastructure?
Okay. The next item on your agenda, Mr. Chair, the data center consolidation that was previously reviewed by this committee in the interim and your committee during the and then Ways and Means during the session had a budget note accompanying this budget that required it to report to this committee at each meeting and the emergency board, and also the Department of Administrative Services was asked to unschedule about $40 million of the second year of operation of the data center pending reports and the recommendations of the e-board. So the Department of Administrative Services submitted a report to the emergency board. This committee hadn't been constituted yet, but they were required to report. They're coming to you again with an update on the data center consolidation. That's the next agenda item, number three. They will be coming back at every meeting of this committee. They also, agenda item number four then, which is an update on the cybersecurity, which the legislature has provided funding for as an ongoing project during this biennium. This committee actually recommended funding of it during the last interim. to start up for cybersecurity. So the Department of Administrative Services is here with two updates for you. I know that's a little more than you asked for.
You're not a role.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lori Warner. I'm the acting director for the Department of Administrative Services. And with me this morning is Mark Ryer, who is the data center administrator. This is a report, as Dallas indicated, that's required by the budget note in House Bill 5166. So we will be speaking with you each time you meet and updating you about where we are with this particular project, as well as reporting to the emergency board. The project's goal is to improve the efficiency and effectiveness and security of the state information technology assets and information. There are 12 agencies that are participating in this project, and they form the governing board that oversees the project and the decisions that are made about how things move forward. There's been some important dates just historically that I'll just run over here with you for a minute. In July of 2004, the governing board adopted a business case and presented that to the governor. And the governor then supported the consolidation of the data centers from the 12 agencies. And that moved forward to the e-board and JLCIMT in September 2004, where they were briefed on the project as well as they approved the construction of a new data center. Then in July of 2005, at the end of the session, the legislature approved the budget for this biennium for the project, some one-time costs of $38 million and operating costs of $61 million. And then in September of 2005, that actual data center building was finished. We had an open house for that that folks were invited to. The facility is on Airport Road here in Salem. There's about 45,000 square feet in size. It is certified as a Tier 3 facility, meaning that it's 99.98% availability uptime. The current data centers that the state's operating in agencies would not meet the criteria for a Tier 1 data center, so a significant improvement for the state. Some milestones in terms of what's happened with the project. First and foremost, having the project approved and the building completed is important. Then we hired Mark Ryer as the data center administrator in late July to come and operate the facility and deal with the transition from the agency. He has a private sector background and a number of years of experience with data centers. So that was a key piece for operating of the facility. We are now in the process of the detailed design of the network and computing infrastructure by the work groups and the steering committee. That's been completed, and network connectivity to the data center has been established currently. What are we going to do in the next 6 months? Basically, right now, we're trying to consolidate the management of the networks from the 12 participating agencies. The largest three agencies, of course, are the biggest players, which is ODOT, Department of Administrative Services, and Department of Human Services. We're going to begin moving computing infrastructure of the three largest agencies and doing the transition planning for those three agencies that are going to be the first ones moving into the center. That's scheduled to occur in the spring and be completed by the June timeframe for the three largest agencies. The last thing I would mention to you that we're doing is we're completing analysis of the 0305 agency expenditures for IT to refine the data center budget and the savings piece that we articulated in the business case, and we would expect to be back talking to you in the April-ish timeframe about what we've learned from doing the look back on what the 0305 expenditures and positions were. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think that we'll open up to questions here, both Mark and I. Mark, on the more technical questions.
Senator Montana.
Yeah. In DHS, I know that epidemiology has always had their, or communicable disease has had their own standalone system. Are they going to be required to be a part? I mean, are you making any waivers? Is DHS making any waivers that certain departments don't have to be...
At this point, DHS is fully participating with all of their programs coming into the data center, into that infrastructure.
Especially with bioterrorism, et cetera, I would hope that they would all be linked, and that with at least within the DHS system that there aren't going to be turf issues, which there were back when I was in public health, back in the late 80s and early 90s, and maybe it's changed now.
Madam Chair, Senator Miles Anderson, I believe that epidemiological systems are in scope. There are a few systems within the state that have special requirements that to date are out of scope. That is, they're not going to be part of the data center. But the epidemiological system is not one of them, to my knowledge.
Do you know which ones are?
Well, for example, the switch that runs the state police, a very specialized system that is in the emergency building itself, that will be a standalone system. But there's just a few handfuls of those that are very, very specialized and probably don't make sense to be a part of the consolidation itself. And it's a rare exception.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Krupp.
Thank you. Lori, when are you going to need, when are you going to come to us in E-Board and ask for the other $40 million that we've reserved?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, basically what we estimated at the time we did the budget and discussed this with LFO and the committees, budget committees, was that we expected that we would have enough limitation to go through this first year, and so that we would not be likely to be asking for limitation until towards the end of the first year of this biennium. So I'm not exactly sure when the e-boards are scheduled to meet, but that we would be back to you, you know, April, May, June, whenever that time frame is for the limitation for the following year. Mm-hmm. Basically, the second year was unscheduled.
Mr. Chair, members, June 20th is the date closest to year end for this committee.
Okay.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The business crisis that was presented to us is predicated upon the savings essentially from personnel by integrating systems. Are we still on track with that? In other words, the positions that were originally eliminated or that are going to be eliminated over time, are we still on track with that, or are you finding that you need more people to make this consolidation work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I think part of the purpose for us going back and looking at taking a due diligence look at the 0305 expenditures in agencies and positions after the biennium closed was to make sure that we had identified what those positions, all the positions, as well as all the service and supply expenditures for hardware, software, that type of thing. So we're currently going through that process. And at this point, I don't have an answer for you as to whether we think, you know, it's more or less than where we were, because we want to validate all of that and have that discussion with you. And about the April time frame is when we think we'll have that all completed with the agencies. In terms of the original 155 positions, we are on track for those positions, yes. The question is, are there additional positions or not? And do we have the right number of positions identified to operate the data center? So we're doing both sides of the coin here, and we don't have that work completed yet to answer your question.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would assume, Lori, that if you're going to if you come back to us at some point and say, we've reevaluated, we need more people to run this thing, then doesn't that affect the entire business case? Because it's based on savings with personnel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, it most certainly does. Because it was a combination of both personnel savings as well as what we call service and supply dollars, the hardware, software, other related expenses. So it does affect all of that. And we need to be certain that we have both sides of the pieces identified here.
And so, Mr. Chairman, also, are you on schedule for the consolidation? In other words, is this thing going to be fully operational when you said it would be?
Yes, we, Mr. Chair and Representative Krupp, we are on schedule. We're actually slightly ahead of schedule. We are running right on budget as well for the consolidation. So we do feel very confident that this will be complete and operational in the time frame that we set. We changed a bit in the way we're doing it. We're doing a kind of a two-phase approach to the consolidation. We're migrating existing systems and processes into the data center. Once they're there, we will then be integrating into a consolidated platforms themselves. And we feel that that's not only a higher degree of quality assurance, but also will take a lot of the risk and a lot of the time required to do some of that risk mitigation.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may
follow up, Representative Crum.
So, again, if you've changed that methodology slightly in terms of moving old equipment, old systems into the building, and then starting the consolidation, isn't that going to put you behind?
No, it's. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Krupp.
That's fine, Mark. Okay. Appreciate that.
I 4 months into the state government.
We'll be gentle. It'll be okay.
28 years in the private sector. No, that was done. It was my belief that actually re-engineering the systems while we are migrating them at the same time would have actually elongated the time frame because of the degree of quality assurance and testing. So moving those systems into and getting the organization in place to support those systems, the organization that supports those systems today, will actually streamline the decision processes that it takes to go to a common platform. I believe that it would actually save quite a bit of time.
I have more, Mr. Chair, if you'll allow me.
Certainly.
Three or four more. Okay. I'll accept that answer and explore it further with you, perhaps. One of the things that I found interesting during the legislative session, Representative Dallum and I were getting a number of communiques from individuals who work for various state agencies that are going to be integrated. Right. People with concerns about processes. And this was one of them, I must say. Examples such as the server group being told which equipment that they were going to purchase before the server group had even met to make a recommendation. Those types of things caused a great deal of concern with us in terms of where we were really headed with this project. And it would be my hope that migrating the existing systems in first rather than trying to re-engineer during the migration period would add us some stability there and lead us to less problems down the road. The question I have to ask, though, is then, are you now, once you get everyone migrated in, are you going to have major design changes that will affect the overall cost of the project?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, if I can go back, when I did start here, there was a great deal of opposing opinions from the technical workforce, and some that were supporting. And of course, if you get enough engineers in a room, you'll get enough answers in that same room. However, I don't believe that that there was a perception or a feeling that the technical people were as much of a part of the decision-making process as they felt they should be. And whether that was real or not, I wasn't here, but perception is reality. And of course, when we're trying to operate a data center with 93 people in a facility, if they didn't buy into the design, they didn't buy into the engineering, and they weren't a part of the build-out, then it would be awfully hard to ask them to support it. And so as a result of that is why we changed. And the thought is that once the systems are there and the teams are there, that the teams amongst themselves, in a much more democratic process, not fully, but much more democratic process, that the technical people themselves can decide what the best architecture there is. It's important for us managers to make sure that while there are technical solutions and technical architectures that need to be implemented, that at no time do we compromise the running of the state government. We have a large application base. Much of it is very customized. We've heard some this morning. You hear about them all of the time, the epidemiological systems. In no way can we do any harm, if I use that term, to compromise those systems. And so we need to architect and re-engineer in such a way that it doesn't impact those systems. And that's really the trick and the hard work of any kind of re-engineering process.
Mr. Chair, two more, and then I'll shut up.
Certainly. Shut up is a strong language, Representative Crumpler.
For being in the radio business, some people think it's appropriate. So there you go. Two questions remaining here. I understand, have you had changes in subcontractors? I understand there's some subcontractors that have decided to leave the project, specifically in security. What's going on there?
Okay, I don't know of any subcontractors that have left the project. Now, the security project itself, you'll be hearing from that right after me, so there may be some individuals that have left that project I'm not aware of, but as far as the data center project itself, we have not had any subcontractors, at least in the last 4 months, or any that I'm aware of that have left that left the project.
Okay, so no contractors that have contracted with the state to do scenic have walked away from the project. Everybody's still there. Everyone's still working. Okay. And last question, Mr. Chairman, if I may, is are you remodeling the control room over there?
Remodeling. One of the important attributes of running an enterprise data center is to have a single command center. A single command center is a similar to what you see in the Johnson Space Center command center. It's not that elaborate or expensive. But what that affords is to have a small team providing 24/7 coverage of security, of the network, of the systems, of the applications, both the and as well as the physical infrastructure itself. And so by having that command center structure there with the monitors there, it allows for, again, 24/7, just a few operators to be able to monitor all of that in case anything happens. So it'll be a significant improvement in our monitoring and management of any system and network anomalies, as well as any security threats that may happen. We can dispatch right away from that command center. Now, that's different furniture. It's not a remodel. It's furniture that we're actually going to bring in there that will actually hold those monitors themselves, the consoles themselves. I'm not sure if that's what you're referring to, but that we will be putting that into the command center. But as far as any movement of walls or any remodeling, there's none of that that's going on.
So, Mr. Chair, you're not spending any more money to do this, basically?
We haven't spent all of our scenic project money, so that will come out of the COP that's already been approved. Are you referring to facility?
Yeah, it strikes me, first of all, I agree with the concept, number one. I think it's a smart thing to do. I guess I'm struck by the fact that you're now making the change to do that. I would have thought that that would have been in the original plan, number one. And secondly, how much money do you have left over from the project, from the building of the building that you have to play with here? And where's it going to go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp. The center that Mark's talking about was originally designed into the building. The fit-out of that room, as to the specifications of the equipment and the layout and stuff, is, I think, what you're talking about that is being done now. But that isn't a remodel. That was planned in the design of the building. And if you want an update on budget numbers and stuff, we'll have to get back to you. If you want to go through that, I'd be happy to do that with you one-on-one with where we are in terms of spending on the project.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would request you bring it before this committee. Not one-on-one. I would think you would want to share that with the entire committee. If you came in under budget, wonderful. That's great. That means you've got money left. Where's it going to go?
Well, Mr. Chair, we're not finished, Representative Krupp, we're not finished with this project yet, so it is an ongoing spending as we move through the project. And I think you got a budget update in the letter that I sent in terms of saying some of the expenditures we expected to make in the first quarter of the biennium we're making in the October, November, December time frame, so the dollars have shifted out. But that doesn't mean they're not being spent. So I'll be happy to bring that next time when we do an update if you'd like to have that information.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I would request that, and it would be up to the chairs to ask staff
Mr. Chair,
but I would appreciate having that.
Just a follow-up, I know that on the last page of under Section 3, the letter from you, you did say that you spent $4.3 million in the 2003-05 state fiscal period, and your total expenditures totaled $0.5 million, well below $11 million. Well, I guess the 4.3 plus 0.5 would be 4.8. So you're still
we're behind
below
where we originally projected the expenditures would be due to the fact that some of the hardware is being purchased in the October, November, December time frame as opposed to July, August, September. But it's probably easier to bring back the numbers laid out for you so you can see spending the day compared to budget. That's what I think Representative Krupp's asking for.
Yep. Yes. Thank you.
Senator Nelson, you had some questions.
Yeah, just one. In view of the previous testimony, in view of the fact that this consolidation is supposed to, for the state for computing and network infrastructure to achieve efficiency and security, consolidating that we're talking about building a whole new system, give me some reassurances that somehow this thing is all going to fit together.
Right. It's a very typical computer consolidation that once the facility is complete, and I know of no additional funds that are required for the facility itself, but the important steps are, get the organization together that's going to be providing the support for those systems. So we're in the process of hiring the teams, hiring the managers now. Move the existing systems where it makes sense to move those. In some cases, we will actually upgrade those to new systems because some of the current servers are very, very old and shouldn't be moved. So we'll upgrade those in the agency itself. So the process is really to move the equipment as it exists today from the current 12 agency data centers into the new data center, and that is a non-disruptive process. And
yeah,
nothing has been changed.
Maybe I didn't make myself clear. I mean, okay. I'm just saying from the testimony from the last witnesses on the Oregon State Patrol and those sort of things. I mean, basically they're asking us to come up with this huge amount of money to create a new system. I mean, how does that potential or proposal to create a new system fit into all this consolidation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, if you're speaking about, is there overlap between the interoperability project you were just hearing about and the data center consolidation, is that what you're speaking to?
Mm-hmm.
Those are two different systems. So we will have some of the state police, and maybe Mark wants to speak to that, network information and such, but the radio network they're talking about being interoperability and building that is completely different than the data center.
Yeah, it says you're state computing that network infrastructure. I mean, we're talking about a network infrastructure, and so I'm kind of, the looseness of terms here is kind of bothering me, and so.
It is complicated, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson. The wireless network and the microwave network that the previous group was talking about, we won't be managing that. We, being the data center, won't be managing that. However, there is a great deal of voice and data traffic that I believe is part of their network that rides on the state backbone, and it should. And we manage that state backbone. We manage it for availability, and we manage it for performance. And so there will be some sharing of that bandwidth, as we do for all agencies today. There'll be some sharing of that bandwidth with the various agencies.
Thank you.
Just, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Sort of follow.
I have Senator Morris waiting with a question. Very patient.
Thank you. To follow up on Representative Krebs, do you see anything in developments to date that would change your business case analysis with respect to the savings? And Representative Krebs addressed the labor issue, and I do have some concerns about that, particularly in light of your language, Lori, on milestones to be achieved in the next 6 months. But recognizing that any project has a degree of fluidity and changes do occur, and to the extent that you can keep from surprising us would be appreciated. If there are any material changes that would suggest that the business case analysis is not what it was presented to be.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I think the issue for us, as you know, as we've moved through this project, is you know more today than you knew yesterday as you move through and evaluate that. And as Mark has come on as the data center administrator, having managed multiple data centers and consolidation projects, his input has been valuable. So we are going to take another look at the information that we had in the business case and evaluate that. I think that's due diligence with the session or the 0305 biennium being closed and see. To date, we don't see anything that causes us a lot of trouble, but we're in the process of going through with each agency and looking at those numbers again. So we will have more to say about that, and we will keep you fully informed.
Thank you.
Yes.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to think of a situation and maybe it exists now, but it's becoming, say, very critical for various agencies to do background checks and fingerprinting, et cetera. And say we wanted to have certain agencies access this information. Is this the type of coordination that will be happening with this data center, or is that something else? Would that be somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, are you asking the degree of background checks we will have for the people in the
building? I mean, is that something that this data center will provide? I mean, so that one agency, say the daycare centers, can do a background check and put their... I don't know enough about, you know, when you do your fingerprinting, you know, how that's registered and where that's registered, but is that going to be a part of this system?
You can think of the data center as and what we're doing as a pure infrastructure, the lumber and the plumbing of the house, but the applications that provide services such as criminal background checks still remain the responsibility and the administration of the agencies themselves. So if that's an OSP or corrections or DHS application, the degree that those applications actually interoperate amongst themselves at this point would be a requirement on the application layer. I don't want to get too technical, but it's not really the infrastructure. We're really dealing with the facility, the network, and the actual physical computers that those applications run on. And so the applications themselves are another layer of complexity that would have to interoperate to allow different kinds of systems to talk to each other.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. If I could follow up on what you're saying, if I understand, and I've been through a lot of consolidations. My background is business consulting, specifically in computer and data analysis. And so what you're saying is that you're a repository for the applications, and any integration of applications would be up to the various departments to make that decision and do that integration. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Raleigh, that is exactly correct. I will say that having a shared infrastructure, such as shared storage and shared network, makes that somewhat easier, but there's still an application level of responsibility.
Any other? Just a few questions. First, thank you, Mark and Lori, for your time. I would ask that, because there's only two of us holding over from the regular session, and we did get a plan, a detailed plan, a plan that encompassed two volumes. And I know for myself, I read it. And I think that it would put, and we struggled mightily to get that plan. Mm-hmm. We did not get that plan until the 11th hour and until we threatened withholding funding. That rattled the cages in this building. And so I would really like that plan to be in the hands of the other members of the committee. Not so much that I don't think they want to read it, but I think that if something... if something's going on, they can go to the plan and see where we were. Mm-hmm. And I think that would put them at great comfort. Mm-hmm. The second thing I'd like to say is the lift and move. Now, I don't know how long that has been part of the plan, but it's been part of the plan as long as I've been here.
Right.
So that doesn't shock me. And if these people had that book, the notion was to uninterrupted service, lift the box, set the box down, and then as time ran on, move functions of each box into the huge computer. But I would ask that you get that information. The other thing that I would ask, another area that we pressed mightily during the session, was personnel. And Ms. Warner, Lori to me, Lori provided us a list with anticipated cuts, and that too was... And if you would give that to these people. And the third thing I think that might really help them, if there are major change orders, I do not want to, for my part, I'll have to look at my co-chair, micromanage. But when there are change orders that are of some magnitude, if we could look at those. I think the biggest thing that we have to build here is a relationship where we're very comfortable with what you're doing. I'm there in a lot of places, but I would really want my fellow committee members to be as comfortable as I am. Mm-hmm. So if you could get those pieces of information for them, I'd
be happy to.
Thank you very much. So any other questions? If not, we're done.
That, no, we have one more agenda item.
Oh, security.
Cybersecurity.
Cybersecurity.
Rather significant undertaking.
Mr. Chair, while Teresa's coming up and they're getting ready to talk about security, may I ask a question? Thank you. And it's really to Lori. And Lori, that is, I know that in August our state CIO left. I won't ask anything about that in this public forum. However, do we have a new state CIO, and who is it? If we do, who is it, and when do we get to meet him?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kremel, we're in the process of doing the interviews, which will happen in the next 2 weeks for the CIO job, and we had over 250 some applicants for that job. So we should know by the end of the year who the new CIO is, and I can have whomever that is certainly come and speak with you in January if you would like to have that done.
Who's the applicant?
Mr. Chair, I would like to have the opportunity to meet the person both in the forum as well as sure. Individually. And do we have an acting CIO?
Yes, Mike Zanin has been the acting CIO since Don Fleming left, as you indicated, in August.
And if I may,
certainly.
Mike unfortunately has left the room, but he's been here through the meeting.
Is that the guy that was sitting back here with his the thing in his ear?
No.
Oh, he was sitting over there. Okay.
Mustache and the trench coat that just walked out the door. Timing in life is everything.
You know, it is.
We're getting close here.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. My other question is that I'm going to assume that the people that have applied for this position have reasonable experience and qualifications to do that kind of a job?
At least the one they pick.
Mr. Chair, Dallas was part of the screening committee that looked at the 15 or so candidates to screen down to a pool of 3 to 5 to interview in the final interview. So he maybe can comment about his review and participation in that process.
Sure, would you?
Sure, Mr. Chair. They have some very strong candidates, at least on paper, and they've done... But the recruiting office has did its work pre-screening, and they've been doing follow-up due diligence. And we, a group of about 8 of us, reviewed them and came to a consensus with 4, and I believe one person dropped out. So they have 3 that are coming to in the next couple of weeks.
Next week.
Right. Very, very experienced.
I only bring that up, Mr. Chair, because we did go through a period of time earlier in this century when we had people, I think the person being put in that position, it was kind of an afterthought. And unfortunately for both them and the state, they were in a position that they were out of their league. Nice people, great people, and maybe good managers, but as far as understanding the technology and everything, they didn't have that background. And I think it's more important that we have people that understand the technology. Well, they have to have good managerial skills too, don't get me wrong, but I think that having that technology background is extremely important for a position like state CIO.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, I think in terms of the criteria that was looked at in hiring a new CIO, what was important was a good, solid technical background. We had hoped that we'd get candidates that had both private sector and public sector experience. Don Fleming happened to have some of both, and so that made it easier for him to understand state government and work within it. I think the candidate pool that we have, the folks have mostly private sector background and strong technical skills, but they will have to learn, whoever this is, I believe, will have to learn the public sector decision-making process and working with the legislature and those types of things. But I think we'll find someone who will be a good strong fit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence.
With that, I believe we can move to the last item on the agenda, which is security.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've asked Teresa Massey to join me here. She is the administrator for the Enterprise Security Office, and this is an update on where we are with security issues in the state. In 2004, DAS contracted for a vulnerability assessment of agencies participating in the community. The scenic project itself, because we realized in consolidating into the data center, we needed to first and foremost assess where those agencies were. That assessment revealed that the state information was vulnerable to unauthorized access. And I think the past has been that each agency has done their own determination of security measures and operated independently. And so when we're talking about operating in a consolidated way, that was not going to work anymore. In response to the assessment results, which were unacceptable levels of risk that people felt we were exposed to as a state, the January e-board funded $8.2 million to take some short-term actions. And there were 4 of them that were started. The single perimeter project, and that provides controls for traffic entering and leaving. The state network is closely monitored, filtered, and managed. The incident response team, when you have an attack, a team was created through a contract with Symantec for technical assistance to develop a program that allows the state to respond rapidly to those hostile environments. Third thing was patch management initiative, enabling timely automated patches and updates to application and operating systems. And finally, an identity and access management project to establish a comprehensive statewide approach to identity users accessing the state information and system and authorizing what data they're allowed actually to access. So that's a short-term program that got started in January 2005, so short of a year ago when we talked to the emergency board The long-term enterprise security program is currently really under development. In the next months, we need to put together an enterprise information steering committee that can provide guidance and oversight to the enterprise security efforts, much like the Scenic Governing Board does for the data center project. We also need to implement programs and projects in the business plan that are geared more to long-term issues through completion of a risk assessment and policies and standards. And Teresa can speak more to those for you if you have particular questions. But really, this security, enterprise security project and program long-term for the state is just in the beginning phases. The budget summary is such that I mentioned to you the January e-board approved $8.2 million to begin those short-term actions. The legislature, when it met, provided $14.5 million in additional COP authority for continuation of the projects and building of the long-term security program for the state. We have issued $6.9 million of the state, that 14-some million COPs in October. And depending on where we are with spending, we wouldn't issue the remainder of the COPs till the spring. The budget for the office itself is $14.7 million. Seven of it is for operations, and the other $7.5 is covering debt service for the COPs. And, of course, all of this is paid through assessments out to the agencies that participate across the enterprise, and so they fund basically these efforts in the Central Enterprise Security Office. So with that, Teresa can answer any technical questions you might have about the program.
Yes, Senator Moore.
Thank you. In the previous interim, Lori, we had a sense of an emergency.
Yes.
Have we pretty well remedied that with the single perimeter project?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, we have taken a lot of action since we met with this group earlier in the year. The single perimeter project has moved along aggressively. We've purchased equipment. We have an architecture developed, and we're starting to migrate agencies into that new environment. So we're really pleased with the progress we're making. We're not finished by any stretch of the imagination. We will continue to migrate more agencies into that environment, but we want to do that thoughtfully and slowly so that we don't interrupt business.
So would we say we have less urgency? I think we still think it's an urgent problem that we're addressing, and we're at the beginning of that process. And the single perimeter was the first step in terms of taking to try to begin to address the traffic. But I don't think we feel that we have that ultimately under control yet.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Just my sense of this whole meeting is, I mean, we're talking about a fair amount of money. I mean, 8.2, 14.5, 14.7, on and on, and then whatever the other projects are. And I go back to the first time I sat on this committee back in 97, we had the DMV, and all of a sudden, you know, there was a huge project there. And I think my level of discomfort is, in fact, are we as a legislative hearing board setting ourselves up here? I mean, how do we make sure this stuff is going all right, so all of a sudden we don't read the paper where somehow the joint committee has failed to really ask the right questions or do what we're supposed to do? And I just go back to the old DMV thing. That, you know.
I might answer that question for you, Senator. Sure. In fact, it's an area on the agenda that I want to look at. We did ask for salary and office space and desk for oversight personnel for this committee because of the scope and sequence of the project. I'm not sure how we're going to deal with that, but we'll be talking with Dallas. That's and okay. See where we sit on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, you know, these were updates given to you, and perhaps this committee would benefit from taking a step back and going through a more detailed review of the process that got us to where we are today. We did share that with a number of you as we went along in the interim last time, but some time has gone by, and it may be helpful. I'm not sure we would be here 3 hours that interoperability was, but These are brief updates and are not the in-depth piece, and you may want to have that in-depth piece. We'd be happy to do it with slide, you know, overhead slides and things that would walk you through the pieces, and that may be something you want to spend some time on, and we'd be happy to do that.
I would also recommend, Lori, that you give each member of this committee a briefing on our present security status.
Mm-hmm.
I know that was most helpful for me. In fact, I see our charge as twofold. One is to consolidate IT, and probably the more important, in my view, is provide security for present IT. And I think that's more appropriately done on an individual basis. And we'll ask these people to get with you so that you're up to speed on security and your comfort level goes up.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
On your third page of the letter you sent to us, you, under Phase 1 Short-Term Action Plan, when you say, and that started in January, or at least that's when the emergency board authorized $8.2 million in certificate of participation, where are we in the vulnerability assessment? Has that been completed?
The vulnerability assessment was completed, and that actually was the basis on which we established these four projects.
Okay.
We will, on an ongoing basis, though, continue to have assessments, both vulnerability assessments and risk assessments, to ensure that we're on track and that we are making progress in reducing risk.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monson, I think that's the piece that Representative Dallin was speaking to. We did brief members before, because security issues can be kind of sensitive on the level of threat we had and where we thought each agency was that was involved in the scenic project and how we were going to move forward. And I think that is appropriate that we come back around and update people. Time has gone on.
Thank you. Mr. Chair? Yes, Representative Crummell.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. One is to follow up on a question that Representative Krupp had asked earlier. Teresa, are the security contractors and subcontractors still on board, or has anybody left the project?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krummel, no contractors have left the project. However, we are in the process on several of the projects of going through a competitive bid. As some members may remember, the DAS director implemented emergency declaration, which expedited the procurement process and allowed us to move forward more quickly. But as we're going through this process, we want to ensure that we're are being appropriate in our procurement and allowing competitive bids on various projects. And so all of the subcontractors and contractors are still on board, but we are going to go through this process. Some of them may be renewed as part of that, and some of them may not. So,
okay. If I may, Mr. Chair,
absolutely.
Is the money still being spent as it was originally appropriated, or have there been any major changes to that? Still.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, all of the money was spent according to the schedule that we provided. We had a very detailed outline of what the money was going to,
mm-hmm.
how it was going to be allocated. We also had that for the recent COP approval that we received, how the money was going to be spent. I think all of it will continue to go for the four projects because we have a lot of work to do, as well as there's a few other items that we have. We want to do a risk assessment, so that's part of it. We need to develop an enterprise strategic plan, and we also have some money allocated for a forensic lab at the enterprise level. So those are the only additional projects that have been added overall.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly.
on the security, you've implemented now, or you're starting to implement on the short-term basis, Phase 1, which is the perimeter plan, and then you'll be moving into the enterprise. But my question is, have you been getting any or a lot? Have you been getting pushback, let me just put it that way, from the agencies, particularly the agencies that are going to be going into the data center, but agencies in whole, because I think all state agencies basically are going to fall under this security plan. So have you been getting pushback from them, or are they sort of saying, okay, we understand and we're with you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, we've been having very strong support from the agencies. We work very closely in partnership with them. There isn't anything we do in the Enterprise Security Office that doesn't involve the agencies. So they're very up to date. They have a very strong sense of ownership of what we're doing, and they're very committed from an enterprise basis to be involved, recognizing that all of us are interconnected, and we can't afford to have a weak link. So I haven't received any comments to suggest that that the agencies aren't very supportive of what we're doing.
Okay, thank you. And then just a comment, Mr. Chair. One of the areas in IT spending that many times gets short shrift, I would just sort of mention to the committee, is the security issue. And yet it is one of the most important things that we can be spending money on. Because if we shortchange the security side of it, we leave our systems in general, we leave our customers in particular, and that's every resident of the state of Oregon is a customer, and we also leave our clients. And the difference between a customer and a client is a client that is actually receiving some kind of state service. You'll remember in December of 2002, the DHS was attacked several times by hackers, and there was some information, particularly client information, that was compromised. We cannot afford to have that kind of information compromised. And we cannot afford to have that kind of security breach occur again. And I think that it definitely raised a security issue for everyone. I happened to be working in computer security at the time, and so I was particularly interested in what was going on. But I just want to point out that for an enterprise our size, I think, you know, the amount of money that's been appropriated on a security basis probably is even still a tad bit low. But if it's enough to get the job done, that's what's important. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And if this is something you want to do at a later time, that's fine. If you can answer the question here, I will admit, first of all, I know nothing about internet, computers, anything. I hit the wrong button and I have to rely on somebody else to kind of get me going. I mean, it's just not my bailiwick. I understand how important it is, but don't ask me to explain it. What I do understand and have a concern about, and just seeing if this is something you have identified, is in terms of proprietary systems. I mean, in my own business, we are a security business, but not that kind, where we do assessments of physical, operational, procedural security. And one of the things that we're very careful about, and in our discussion of interoperability, they made a point of saying standardized systems so you don't get caught in proprietary systems that basically hooks you with a vendor, and when you try to add and change things, you can't do it without sticking with someone in which you pay full retail. And this is very big in these types of security systems. So I guess my question to you is this a priority to make sure as you go through this first phase of looking at the type of hardware and software and other types of architecture that you are getting advice on? Is it a priority to make sure that the system can be built upon with continually competitive bidding as you move that system forward, or are we in a position where we might get locked into a particular supplier, vendor, and have to look at a whole new system? Otherwise, you kind of get locked in on that. I just wonder if that's a priority and if there's any steps to make sure that the system can grow and it can grow competitively, you know, as we look for, you know, future supplies and materials.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, that's absolutely a priority for us, and we look at that as we develop our architecture to make sure that we don't get locked into something that in the long run may cause us difficulty. So we recognize that as being important, as the other group mentioned. There may be some instances where it's most cost-effective to do that, or the vendor pool is so limited that clearly there's only one vendor that can really offer the type of service or products that we need, but we would hope that would be on a very, very limited basis, and we would have to look very seriously before we entered into that kind of an agreement.
And just a follow-up, Mr. Chair, and then making sure also that if you have those limited vendor situations, mm-hmm. that we're very careful about the contracting, and they will support those systems even if they move on to other designs and programs.
absolutely. Yes.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Comments? It seems in... That should finish the agenda?
That completes the agenda, Mr. Chair.
It should seem in wrapping up that in the January meeting, we will talk a little bit more about interoperability and some funding for that before they go to the board. We will talk about scenic, continuing construction money, and do some talking about oversight. Anything else, Dallas, we're going to talk about?
No, Mr. Chair. There may be other reports and requests to the emergency board that will come through this committee, and we're somewhat here to serve the emergency board too, help it.
And Mr. Chair, I know that the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council at some point will want to make a report. I attended a meeting earlier in the year, and they're working on some proposed legislative concepts.
And they submit that legislation to this committee, which introduces it on their behalf.
Very good. Thank you all. Again, I apologize for the lateness of my arrival.
All right.
I just have one thing. If there are any members that really do not want two big binders of scenic plans,
yes, very good.
You are welcome to come down to the Legislative Fiscal Office, where I happen to have a copy of those, and you can peruse them and read them at your pleasure.
Or to my office.
Yeah, I'd like to have it just on electronically if that's possible. Is it still available electronically?
Is that?
That would be easier than paper.
It only takes up four disks.
Well, I mean, you have access to it. I don't necessarily have it.
That would be better.
We don't need two more binders.
Questions, comments, concerns? The Joint Information Management Technology Committee meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.